Support for Boston Public Radio comes from M&M Skylights, offering a wide range of Velux skylight products, installation, and maintenance services to customers from Boston to Portland and surrounding areas. More information at mmskylights.com.
I'm Jim Braddock, today on Boston Public Radio. President Biden will deliver a State of the Union address tomorrow, where he's expected to tout achievements on shooting down the balloon, COVID, climate, and yes, the economy. All the while, though, the majority of Americans, 62% according to a new poll, feel like his accomplishments across 2 years have left something to be desired. Oh, and GOP voters aren't crazy about Trump either, yet they're the only two candidates. What's up with that? We'll ask.
I'm Marjorie Egan. We'll get thoughts from former Democratic congressional candidate Jesse Mermel and former Mass GOP chair Jennifer Nassour back for our Monday political panel. We'll also ask the two of them about New Hampshire losing its first in the nation primary status, at least for Democrats, plus Amy Carnevale taking over Jennifer's former seat as the head of the state's Republican Party. All that to come, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Eakin. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Good morning, Jim.
There was a slight pause there. Were you thinking of not doing the show today? What was that? There was like a two-second pause after you were supposed to start.
I was right here.
You were.
Ready to go.
Okay, fine.
Yes.
Nice to see you. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Well, good. There was a pause there, too. So Republicans are giving former President Trump just short of a coin toss odds on whether they'll support him as the 2024 Republican nominee. That's according to a new poll from the Washington Post and ABC News. Democrats, on the other hand, want anything other than incumbent President Joe Biden, any one other, I guess you should say. The majority of both parties say they'd be dissatisfied, even angry, if either man wins the election. So where are you on this? And is it even a comparison? Biden's time in office and what he's accomplished on the environment, infrastructure, the economy, LGBTQ, marriage, compared to the chaotic Trump presidency and the violent way in which it ultimately ended. What is wrong with our political system that two candidates who even members of their own party have no interest in are the only two candidates so far? And if that doesn't interest you, what do you think about the spy balloon? 877-301 just wanted to slide that in there. 877-301-8970 is the number to call or to text. 877-301-8970. You know, I have a couple of observations from these polls. One, I don't know what the answer to this is. There is something wrong when the vast majority of Democrats don't want the incumbent. A majority, not a vast majority, of Republicans don't want Trump, and they're the only two candidates. That's my first observation. Number two, what is wrong with America that in a poll taken last week, Donald Trump would still beat Joe Biden in a head-to-head matchup? And three, I've got to put this carefully so we don't get in trouble with our listeners. Can the American people, how would I put this, be any dumber than they are? Did you break down this poll? Biden's done nothing on infrastructure. Oh, excuse me. Only the biggest infrastructure bill in history. Nothing on EVs. Mm-hmm. He's made them more affordable. Oh, and 60-some percent says he's done nothing on jobs. Maybe the fact that we have the fastest job growth in the history of the United States of America would counter that. Nothing on drug prices. He capped insulin. I think it's for Medicare recipients. I mean, either he is the worst messenger ever, which may be which is possible, or the American people have absolutely no idea what's going on. And I'll end with what I said a minute. How can people prefer Donald Trump to anybody after what we've learned, not only through his presidency, but through the January 6th hearings and anything else? You have answers to any of those questions?
Well, I think people don't really pay attention.
I think so?
That's one of the problems. Yeah, I think they don't. I think that the so-called economic gloom that they talk about seizing the country despite the fastest job growth in American history has to do with the cost of trying to buy a house, the cost of trying to rent a house, has to do with inflation. It has to do with wages not really improving that much despite some of the
The Fed says they're improving too much. That's one of the reasons they keep raising interest rates.
Well, I think if you're in your own life, if your salary is not included, you know what I mean? It's how things are going for you. So I am kind of surprised. I'm really surprised. We talked a lot about one of the big pandemic relief programs, which was that child tax credit, which lifted almost half of
children in America out of poverty. You're so right.
I was really surprised that nobody noticed that. I mean, they got all this money every month for many, many months, and then all of a sudden it disappeared. Wouldn't you wonder where it came from and where it went? I guess that's what I kind of worry about, and why people weren't haranguing their legislators to do something about it. Maybe people are just totally disengaged.
What do you think
from
what?
What? Go ahead. From politics. From politics.
Well, maybe
now the balloon. On the other hand, Jim, on the balloon, you know, you're out in Montana. Yeah. You look up at the sky and you think, is it a bird? Is it a plane?
Is it a spy balloon?
What is it? It's a Chinese spy balloon, and then it's working its way across the country. And then all of a sudden, they send up, it was like Tom Cruise and Top Gun. They send up the two fighter pilots to go take it out over the water in South Carolina. I mean, then you see the balloon coming down to the ocean instead of to land. I guess they were worried about the debris hitting people's heads as it landed or something.
I wouldn't want one.
But that
on
was
head,
something.
Yeah.
Now, did you know there were three other spy balloons during the Trump administration? I had no idea.
I do now.
Did you know that?
Wait, three during the Trump administration?
Didn't we just discuss this before the show?
Oh, during Trump?
Yes.
Oh, I missed that conversation. So wait a second. Did he shoot him down?
I'm crazy.
Did he shoot him down because the Republicans are trashing Joe Biden?
I think we missed him.
Okay, fine.
Let's double check that.
Okay, good.
I thought we had that conversation before the show, but maybe I've screwed it up completely.
Let's get back to the topic at hand. What is wrong with our political system? And by the way, I know it's only 2023, but primaries and caucuses start in a year from now. The only two candidates we have are completely rejected. Democrats completely reject Joe Biden. And by a modest majority, Republicans completely reject Donald Trump. And they're the only two candidates we have. I mean, really?
Well, I think a lot of the problem with Trump, with Biden, for people is frankly, he looks his age. And I think that's disconcerting to people. And we're going to talk about in our political panel about this, that the fact that you worry that he's 80 now and that he would be 86 by the time that he leaves office. And we've seen the performance of Chuck Grassley, who's like 87, and Dianne Feinstein, who's 99.
She's not 99.
I mean, 89. You say to yourself, that's only a couple of years away from where Joe Biden would be at the end of his term. I think it makes people nervous.
Wait a second. Okay, which is should be a greater concern? That Joe Biden would be in his 80s, or the guy who's beating him in a head-to-head matchup credibly is accused of leading an insurrection, trying to have the results of a Democratic election overturned, paid off a prostitute, sexually assaulted or harassed a couple of dozen women? I mean, really?
Well, I think the what some people might say is that the stock market was doing much better during Trump. Their 401ks went up during Trump. They didn't have inflation during Trump. That may have been it. And, you know, ironically, if I would be asked what was the big achievement of the Trump presidency, I would say the COVID vaccines. But I think the people that support Trump would not say that was a big achievement at all. Anyway, 877-301-8970 is the number, 877-301-8970. There are other people who could run for president of the Republican side. We're seeing talk over the weekend, John Sununu from New Hampshire?
Yeah, he's not running.
You don't think he's running?
No, I don't.
Did you think he looked good on the skis?
I think he looks fabulous on the skis.
With the reporter.
Yeah, I want a president who can ski. That's my criterion. If he or she can ski, you have my vote. If you can't ski, forget about it. 877-301-8970. And by the way, if you have any observations on the spy balloon, because neither Marty and I really grabbed by the thing, and we probably should be, because people are talking about Armageddon in terms of the United States' relationship with China being just around the corner. I am not as engaged as I should be on that.
On the Trump issue. CNN is reporting that the transiting of three suspected Chinese spy balloons over the continental United States during the Trump administration was only discovered after President Joe Biden took office. According to a senior administration official, the Biden administration disclosed last week that a Chinese spy balloon was hovering over Montana. And the Pentagon said similar balloon incidents had occurred during the Trump administration. So indeed, this is not our first Chinese spy balloon, Jim.
Balloon flyover. It's incredible. Right. Let's go.
Bernier in Hyde Park.
Hi,
thank
Bernier.
You for calling.
Welcome.
Hi, Jim. By the way, I did say everything to you.
I saw the email. Thank you. I'll be checking it out. I can't wait.
Okay, great. You know, this is a very depressing issue because I feel like I'm truly beginning to believe that the framers of the Constitution, the people who started this country, did not plan a country for the masses. Originally, the country was for rich landowners who were very educated, mm-hmm. not for the masses. And even senators were not chosen
direct election
directly by the populace.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Perhaps we should be thinking about something else because this public now, they don't know what they want. How in the world could they say they don't want Biden when Biden has, I'm talking about the Democrats. Yeah. Biden has done more than so many people.
I agree.
They're not paying attention. Biden has done phenomenally in just 2 years. And if you're a Democrat who pays attention, how could that even come out of your mouth?
I'm with you, but Brunier, getting back to your first point, what is the system that would be better, that wouldn't leave us with two candidates that are not even wanted by members of their own party? What is that system?
Well, I think we need an educational system that teaches people civics, that teach people what it means to be a patriot, not flag draping and you know, Trump humping the flag, nonsense like that, where Americans understand what's going on because immigrants from other countries know how the country works, and people like that vote because in their country they learn patriotism. But in the United States, it's being a citizen doesn't mean anything.
Well,
we don't know what it means to be a citizen.
Sadly, I tend to agree with you. Brunier, thanks for the call.
But
we appreciate it.
Is absolutely right. I mean, how many times have we heard this? You know, the great line from Alexis de Tocqueville when he did the classic Democracy in America said race was always going to be the Achilles heel of the United States of America, which was very true then, it's very true now, and that the country will not survive without an informed electorate. And that means an electorate that has to pay attention. And I think a lot of other people don't pay attention. They've got busy lives or they just don't see how the government impacts their lives. You know, it was really fascinating when there was this What a Difference a DA Makes campaign by the ACLU.
Yep.
Carol Rose is going to be with
yep.
us tomorrow. And here is the person that if you are caught up in the criminal justice system who has tremendous power and his prosecutors or her prosecutors over who gets charged with which crime, mm-hmm. how long you're going to be in jail, they have the discretion to charge you, not to charge you, all these things. People had no idea. They didn't know that the DA was elected. They didn't know it was power.
It's totally true.
And so it's almost as if, you know, Bernier's point about school is a big thing, too. We've lamented forever the civics problem or that we don't really know civics anymore. But before we go on, I just want to point out that Paul has a very important question.
What's he say? What's the question?
He said, where were the Jewish space lasers when the Chinese balloon was over Montana?
Well, I think you should ask Marjorie Taylor Greene what the answer to that question is.
And that's a very important question because, of course, Marjorie Taylor Greene mm-hmm. believes that she's a congresswoman, of course, very powerful now in the Republican Party, that Jewish space lasers are interfering in all sorts of areas in our lives, and I think we should get to the bottom of that.
Do you remember when de Tocqueville also said, get your balloon out of my airspace? Do you remember that? That's not as quoted nearly as often, but obviously it's topical right now, and he was really ahead
yeah.
of his time.
Alex and Walpole, thank you very much for calling.
Alex, hey.
Hey, thank you. I am long-time caller, first-time listener.
Well, thank you.
Actually, that's happened.
Long-time caller, first-time listener. That's a new one, Alex. That's a twist on the usual.
Alex was laughing at himself, which is really quite odd, Alex. You know what I mean? But go ahead.
Well, I have tried. Well, it might be because my area code is a Utah area code. I'm from Utah originally.
Oh.
I've been here about 10 years. I was going to tell you, Jim, I probably shouldn't run for office because I don't ski.
Well, you should. Find something else to do with your time. That's all.
I was going to say, though, that Nikki Haley, I thought, had announced.
She said it's likely. She hasn't. No, we talked about that briefly last week. She's from South Carolina, former governor there. Was she the ambassador to the UN, I think, for Trump? Yes, she was.
Yes.
So it appears she's going to announce, but she has yet to do it. Do you have any explanation as to why you have two candidates that nobody seems to like, Alex?
Well, I feel like because they have such institutional cachet with their respective parties. I mean, I was really actually furious when Joe Biden announced his candidacy. I mean, I grant you Jim, that he has done quite a bit for the country, and it's been widely underappreciated. I think Obama had the same messaging problem where they were able to do some incredible stuff, but just they felt like it would speak for itself. But unfortunately, that's not always the case. But yeah, I do feel like both Biden and Trump at this stage, I feel, and maybe even before, of course, are doing this just for themselves. This is not kind of a George Washington, you know, Roman era Cincinnatus kind of service.
Well, can I argue against you and by extension argue against myself? The most important, someone texted this, and my apologies, I'm not citing it because I can't find the text now, that Biden's primary mission, which he has gone far beyond 2 years ago, was to beat Donald Trump. And he succeeded. And it is possible in Biden's defense, I don't know this to be the case, that he is convinced yet again that should Trump be the nominee, which as of the moment it appears like he will be, and even if he's indicted, he could be the nominee, that maybe he's convinced he's the only person for a second time who could beat Donald Trump. And I have to say, even though I agree with Marjorie that Biden is too old to serve a second term, if I was convinced that he was the only person who could beat Donald Trump, I would say that he is the person who deserves the American people's support. So there you go. Alex, call us again. We really appreciate it. And good luck with the skiing. Appreciate it.
You know, dreaded homing at local angle, Jim.
What is it?
We should have mentioned earlier, some texters mentioned this, but that fighter jets from Massachusetts Air National Guard base
in Westfield
took part in the mission to shoot down the suspected Chinese spy balloon. So, yeah, we want to give credit to the locals. I think that's in Westfield. It is in Westfield. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Let's go to Nauru in the car. Hi.
Hi, Nauru. Nauru, say something.
Do we lose Nauru? Okay.
Okay.
We'll put her on hold there for a second, get back to her. Will from Reading is singing my song.
What is that?
Falls apart a little bit because Democrats are the ones, a lot of Democrats are not keen on Biden and a lot of Democratic-leaning independents. But he also points out that if you are in a right-wing news feed, you know, of Dan Bongino and Fox News and all that kind of stuff, you don't know anything that Biden has accomplished.
Well, that's a ridiculous point, with all due respect to the texter. Democrats, for the most part, don't listen to Dan Bongino.
Well, I said that.
So what's the point?
Well, the point is that a lot of people in America that are with Trump because they don't see that Biden has done anything.
Because
they don't hear.
Oh, we're with Trump. I'm sorry. I thought you meant the Democrats who were saying it. Yeah, that's possible. I mean, I guess it's, you know, you've made that point for years, and you are right. It must be right because just the jobs thing alone. I agree with you. If they're conflating inflation and that sort of thing with jobs, it's fine. But the question, I looked up the question, was how's he done on job creation? And the overwhelming majority of people said terrible.
Yeah, terrible.
It's the fastest job growth in the history of the United States of America, period.
But you know what's funny? You probably don't have any close family members who are in this right-wing bubble.
I do not.
And when you talk to them on the phone and they'll say, did you hear about this? And I'll think, no, I didn't hear about this. And, you know, I'm a news person. This is what I do every day. And, of course, it was a big story, usually a made-up story, in their news bubble.
Well, not all of the time. I actually did get a text from someone over the weekend. Mm-hmm. It is true that for a short period of time, and only for a short period of time, so they exaggerated, Hunter Biden was flying the spy balloon. That is true. But I believe it was over either South Carolina or Utah. I'm not sure where. He did bail out. So it was a half-truth, and it's typical of the right in this country. We got to take a break, Marjorie.
Okay. We're talking about why so many Republicans and Democrats are unhappy with the candidates that may be running for president in 2024. That, of course, would be President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump. And what do you think that Hunter Biden was actually the pilot of the Chinese spy balloon?
Part-time, short for a short period of time.
The number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. You're listening to Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're at the library tomorrow. We hope you join us. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the 2024 election. Well, we're sort of talking about the 2024 election. Based on new polling from the Washington Post and ABC News, people in their own parties don't even want a Biden-Trump rematch in 2024. Why is the system only giving us them if there's such across-the-board dissatisfaction? We also have worked in the spy balloon here and there, not with very much sense. But if you have any thoughts on that, give us a buzz or a text at 877-301-8970.
Have a couple of texts here.
Yeah.
To use a word created by George W. Bush, in my opinion, Joe Biden is the most misunderestimated president in recent memory.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. And then this is from someone who apparently liked Trump a lot better. The reasons: inflation was low, gas was under $2 a gallon, eggs weren't $7 a dozen, no shortages of baby formula, Afghanistan. Now we're on the verge of World War III. He also says the border was closed under Trump. The border wasn't closed under Trump. That's a mistake. But in any case, the other things are all correct.
Yeah, okay. He attempted to steal the presidential election. He attempted to steal the presidential election.
Well,
election,
I guess,
and he is preferred by
48-44
by the voters of America.
Eggs were cheaper under Trump.
Eggs were cheaper. Eggs were cheaper. You know, by the way, do you think, let's assume tomorrow, I mean, Merrick Garland, really? Or whatever his name is, Jack Smith now, the special counsel. Mm-hmm. How many years is this going to take? What is her name? Fannie Willis in Georgia? Did you hear the phone call about 10,000 times when he says to Brad Raffensperger,
yep,
can you find me whatever it was, 11,000 votes?
More than 2 years ago now.
How many decades do they need to investigate this?
I mean, that's another problem.
And by the way, I am not convinced that he still won't be leading in the polls if he's indicted for insurrectionist or the documents or Georgia phone call.
These are all the biggest witch hunts in the history of America.
I guess that's true.
Nara, we've got you on this time, I hope. Thank you for calling.
Hi, welcome.
Hi, my name is Nara.
Nara, hi, Nara. How are you?
Hi.
Great.
Love your program.
Thanks.
So the first point I want to bring up is I don't believe in polls anymore. Who responds to polls? I don't answer phone calls if it's someone I don't know.
Good point.
There are no home phones anymore. Most of the people I know, and I'm older, don't have their home phone or don't answer it.
Yeah.
So how are they getting the poll information? So that's one thing that I think is very, I think it should be queried and not necessarily believed. The other is, I don't know how anyone could vote for Donald Trump. And it's a sad state of affairs to me that people are that misinformed, uneducated, whatever, to not see the real true picture. As for Biden, I think he's done a great job. He did exactly what this country needed after Trump, but he's too old.
He's too old.
It is time to hand over the U.S. political system to younger people, and I mean younger than boomers. It is time for that generation to take over and start to affect their government.
Who would be your non-boomer candidate of choice?
I can't even think of one, and that's what's so sad.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of... We got a bunch of texts in the last 20 minutes. Admittedly, this is a random sampling. Pete Buttigieg fans, I should say. But I don't know either. Nara, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. And sorry we didn't connect the first time. 877-301-8097. As we're going to discuss with Jesse Rimmel and Jennifer Nassour in a couple of minutes, too, the most likely replacement, should Joe Biden, or as a candidate, not run, is Kamala Harris, who, following your question, which we'll play in a few minutes, of Elizabeth Warren the other day, has spawned articles all across the country and television coverage saying that Democrats don't want her either. So,
yeah, well, she was not a good candidate for president and the first time around. And I think the consensus is, what has she done to distinguish herself the second time around? Now, that may be short-sighted. Maybe she's done more. But I don't think she's the person. I think that's going to be very problematic if he runs again, because it's going to be similar to John McCain and Sarah Palin. I'm not comparing Kamala Harris to Sarah Palin, but the upset of thinking that John McCain might die is going to be the same upset with thinking that Joe Biden might die or become incapacitated.
She may not be popular. I don't think most people think she is absolutely, totally incompetent like Sarah Palin was.
You're missing my point.
What?
I think that when you have someone who's as old and feeble-looking as Joe Biden, the vice president becomes huge in your mind. And I'm not sure that Kamala Harris is the person that is going to inspire that kind of confidence in a lot of people voting for Biden.
Okay, we have time for one more quick call. Helen in Falmouth, hi.
No, hi, Jim and Marjorie.
Hey.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, so, look, first of all, I am a big supporter of President Biden. I think he's done a tremendous job for this country. I do agree with the previous callers who said, you know, we need to upgrade how we teach civics to our young people, both in elementary, middle school, high school, and in college. We need to get young people, intelligently involved in the whole process.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that a lot of Americans are very spoiled.
What do you mean, spoiled?
I think they're, you know, when I look around the world and I see what's going on in some of the other countries, I mean, they've had it too good. They don't know what it's like to really suffer some, you know, catastrophic events.
I hear you. And Helen, thanks for the call. I hear the civics thing and I agree with it. I think most sane people have said similar things for years and years. But I'm still waiting for an explanation. Marjorie attempted to give one a minute ago, why a plurality of the American people think that a guy who I think the January 6th committee demonstrated conclusively led an insurrection against our government in an attempt to overturn a democratic election would be a preferable choice to the current president. I mean, that to me, I don't care if it's right-wing media, lack of civics education, eggs were cheaper, whatever you said, Marjorie. That to me goes a lot
deeper. In several states in the country, the election deniers won. You know, they didn't all win, but a lot of them did win. And how many do we have now in the Congress? The election deniers are sitting in the
100 and some people
House.
In the House who voted not to certify the election are still in the House. That is
so
true.
People voted for them.
In all fairness, I'm trying to be more balanced than you are. At least we have some new blood. We have George Santos and people like that, so it's not quite as desperate as you were suggesting.
Okay. We just heard your thoughts on the Chinese spy balloon plus the rematch.
Not really. We heard our thoughts on the Chinese spy balloon. We didn't hear anybody's thoughts on the Chinese spy balloon, but go ahead.
The rematch between Biden and Trump. Jesse Mermel and Jennifer Nasour join us for our next political panel. We'll get into the national landscape, but also ask what's next for the Mass GOP after GOP chair Jim Lyons got the boot. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're joined now on Zoom by Jesse Mermel. Nice glasses, Jesse. And Jennifer Nasour. Mermel is the founder and president of DeWitt Impact Group and a former Democratic candidate for Congress in Massachusetts. Jennifer is the founder of the Pocketbook Project, former chair of the Massachusetts Republican Party, and former candidate for Boston City Council. Jennifer, Jesse, good to see you both.
Nice to be here.
Hey, thank you both for coming in. We much appreciate it. So let's start with you, Jesse. We were just talking with our listeners. You may have heard a little bit of it about a few Americans are very excited about either Biden or Trump in a rematch for 2024. And the over and over thing you hear about Biden is he's too old. So what do you make of it?
I think folks are just burnt out of politics, period, full stop, right? You could have maybe it would take Beyonce running for president, right? After last night's Grammy night for folks to get jazzed. By the way, that's a candidacy I'd like to learn a little bit more about. Listen, I think that if Joe Biden runs again, he is going to have to get people excited by talking about what he has done, you know, around protecting reproductive rights, around fighting for canceling student debt, though I wish he had done more. And obviously the courts are trying to do away with that. Certainly around tackling inflation and the economy. There are plenty of things for folks to get excited about Joe Biden having done what will have been 4 years by the time he's running for re-election. But I'm not sure the White House has done a great job of communicating that and cutting through the lots and lots of noise that's out there. And that's going to be necessary if he's going to launch a re-election campaign. Well, or, you know, maybe he just gets Beyonce to go on the road with him.
So, Jennifer, even if Marjorie and Jesse are right, that there's been horrible messaging, the huge percentage of the American people don't know what Biden's done. Everybody in America knows absolutely everything that Donald Trump has done, yet he is beating Biden in a head-to-head matchup, according to this Washington Post ABC polling. How do you explain that?
So can I just say one thing?
You may say
it's
whatever,
like,
you want.
Listening to this conversation makes me think of Peanuts and the teacher and the wah, wah, wah. Mm. Listen, these are two old guys. Mm. Why are we talking about them? What is the conversation about? They are two old men that are going to be in their 80s when they become, if one of them, God help us, became president. I don't even want to talk about either of them. I think they're both terrible. Neither of them deserve to be president again. And I think we need to move on. Why aren't we talking about the new generation of leaders? And by the way, like, I love the generation of leaders on the right. And I also think that there's a great generation of leaders on the left that could just talk about inspire people to go to the polls.
Like who?
You think either of these old guys are going to inspire anyone to go to the polls?
Like who?
They inspire sleep. They inspire sleep apnea. Like who on the right? I mean,
right, left, who? Who's on your list of the next generation?
On my list, I think you've got great governors on both sides, right? I mean, on my end, I think we have some great people, governors, former governors. I mean, and you guys are going to love my list,
yeah.
But I got Nikki Haley, I have Tim Scott, I have DeSantis, I have, you know, someone, I know, Jesse, you're dying.
Go ahead.
You know, I have Mike Pence, I have Pompeo, I've got Chris Christie. I mean, I've got like lots of people on my list that I think, Sununu, I think would be amazing. So, I mean, for me, I think there are lots of governors, former governors, and people who have been involved in government who actually know what's going on, and they are a different generation. And I think that it's time for us to leave, you know, that spot open. Not that I'm a fan of Gretchen Whitmer, but I mean, you know, she should be up there as a female, you know, in her 50s, like someone like that. Why are we talking about these old guys over and over?
Well, maybe because they're the only two candidates so far. That may have something to do with it. You know, I mean, they are the only two declared candidates.
Yeah, and they're both losers. And so we go back because the Democratic Party thinks that the only person who could beat Donald Trump is Joe Biden. And Republicans haven't gotten away from their, you know, Stockholm syndrome of Trump and have gone out there. But I think that eventually they will. And I think you're going to see Nikki Haley in the next couple of weeks come out. And I think you're going to see others. And there is chatter. But realistically, it is February of 2023. Why would anyone in their right mind start announcing right now, and then they have to have a fist fight with Donald Trump, which seems like such a waste of time when they could wait until September and start campaigning at that point?
Let me just say, the idea of Mike Pence and Chris Christie as the next generation of leaders is enough to make me curl up in the fetal position and never come out.
Jesse.
I can't quite handle it. I mean, I will say there is a lot of chatter on the Democratic side about who from that next generation of Democratic leaders. You know, I agree Gretchen Whitmer has to be on that list. I've heard rumors that Gavin Newsom is gearing up in the event that Joe Biden does not run. So certainly there is movement happening. It is just below the radar screen as people wait to see what the president officially does.
Jesse, Margaret, go ahead.
I have a question for you, Jesse. You hear this over and over again from people that know a lot more about politics than I do, that it's possible, I mean, now people seem to think Joe Biden is running for sure, but that you don't want to announce too soon that you're not running because you become a lame duck and you lose power, et cetera. Is there any possibility that's what's happening with Biden, that he's just waiting and maybe come whatever date, he'll say he's not going to run and then everybody else runs in?
I don't think we can rule it out. And Marjorie, I think you're right. Look at what happened to Dianne Feinstein, right? Like she has tried to not announce and not announce, and now has said she won't announce her decision in California till 2024. I assume so she does not want to look like a lame duck. I mean, she wants to cling to whatever power she can, despite some very credible, exciting candidates running in that California Senate race, regardless of what she does. So yeah, I think, you know, it's human instinct, right? You want to remain relevant.
You know, one name, Jesse, well, actually, neither of you have mentioned, is the current vice president. Senator Warren was in the studio with us last week, a couple of Fridays ago. Marjorie first asked her if she'd support Joe Biden if he ran, and she had a one-word answer. The answer was yes with an exclamation mark. And then she followed up with this. Here's Marjorie's question and then Elizabeth Warren's answer.
If he's that old in a second term, the vice presidency becomes even more important. Should Kamala Harris be his choice the second time around?
You know, I really want to defer to what makes Biden comfortable on his team. I've known Kamala for a long time. I like Kamala. I knew her back when she was an attorney general and I was still teaching, and we worked on the housing crisis together. So we go way back, but they have to be a team, and my sense is they are. I don't mean that by suggesting I think there are any problems. I think they are.
I think most people know that the next day she sent a statement to GBH saying that that isn't really what she meant. She's a firm supporter. But that engendered, Jesse, Washington Post, New York Times, CNN, national coverage, that Democrats don't want Kamala Harris, do they?
I don't think that's fair. That is such a tough job. And she really has been getting out there. As you know, I've worked in the abortion rights space for a long time. And I think that our community is incredibly grateful for the strong, strong leadership that the vice president has shown in the wake of the horrible Dobbs decision last summer. I mean, listen, Senator Warren's not wrong that the president deserves to pick a teammate that he likes. And it seems that they are a good team that's working well together. I think it's, you know, inside the Beltway, D.C. gossip to say that there's something rotten in the state of Denmark.
Jennifer, moving to you, the vote happened this weekend at the Democratic National Committee, I think in Miami. I'm not sure where it was. But in any case, New Hampshire is no longer number one. And the Republicans are keeping New Hampshire at number one. What's the damage potential for both Biden and then maybe even down the line, two senators who I think, fortunately for them, are not running for re-election in 2024, Shaheen and Hassan. What's the potential damage of that decision in New Hampshire with its three electoral votes?
Well, I mean, you know, I think that there's there is some reputational damage that happens, right? It seems as though the DNC is punishing New Hampshire primary voters for not voting for Biden last time around. It seems like this is incumbent protection, which I think it goes to the heart of democracy and, you know, not keeping this as it is. I mean, pushing them from first to second, like, is that really doing much? And also trying to tell a state for a political party to tell a state that they have to abide by their rules, I think also is taking a bite out of democracy. And I mean, in New Hampshire, Republicans control both houses and the governor's office. So the New Hampshire Democrats have been opposed to this. The GOP legislature would need to change it, and it could backfire on Democratic priorities, including voting rights that they're trying to negotiate on. They would have no power there. And so I think, you know, at the end of the day, it is the effect that I would see is that those candidates that all go through New Hampshire, guess where they stop first? They stop in Massachusetts, and that's where they pick up their checks, and then they move on to New Hampshire. And so they are going to lose money because if they're not going to New Hampshire first, New Hampshire is going to lock them out and they're not going to get the money from Massachusetts. And so I think that that's, you know, one of the things that I will say from my perspective. Geez, it is so fun to watch drama on the left for once, because we have had our share of it here in Massachusetts.
We're going to get to the drama in Massachusetts in a second. Jesse, go ahead.
Frostbite on my toes aside, I love the New Hampshire Democratic primary, right? It is so fun. Everyone goes up there. It's great. It does not speak to the diversity of our country.
It does not.
It absolutely does not. And, you know, this, I don't believe this is about politics for Joe Biden. This has been a long time coming. This has been discussed for years and years and years, cycle after cycle. And let's be clear about what happened here. What the Democratic National Committee approved was a primary in South Carolina on February 3rd, and then in New Hampshire on February 6th. New Hampshire will still be darn important. It's New Hampshire and Nevada on February 6th, followed by Georgia and then Michigan. New Hampshire is still going to have an incredible level of influence. All of those candidates will still have a chance to stop by Massachusetts and pick up checks. We will continue to be a major money exporting state. But this much better reflects the diversity of our nation and the diversity of voters in the Democratic Party. And while the nostalgic part of me hates it, shockingly, it is more important to address the needs of a diverse electorate than it is to make me feel better about going up and freezing my tuchus off in New Hampshire.
You know, before we go from national politics to state politics and the change in leadership of the state Republican Party, Marjorie and I were wondering this morning, we were trying to figure out what's the transition to go from the feds to local. And we concluded I assume most people would agree, it would be George Santos doing karaoke. So you have two choices, and we'll allow you to choose. It can either be him singing the Disney classic Let It Go at karaoke, or Leonard Cohen's classic Hallelujah. Which would you prefer, Jesse? We'll ask you first.
Can we just let him go?
Okay, how about you, Jennifer? That's not one of the – which would you prefer?
I'm with Jesse.
Okay, fine. We'll do Let It Go, the Disney classic, karaoke. Here's – actually, he was George DeVolder at this point in the spirit of full – of accuracy. Here he is singing Let It Go.
Let it go, let it go. Can't hold it back anymore.
That's pretty good, actually.
Let it go.
Oh, my God.
Okay, that's about enough. Thank you, George. I mean, Mr. DeVolder, okay. Thank you very much.
Good?
What?
Painful.
You think that was good? Do you need to have your ears checked? I mean, is there a doctor we can call?
It was really, really good. We're talking to Jennifer Nasur and Jesse Mermel, and that was George Santos, of course.
Okay, Jennifer Nasur, the Mass GOP has picked a new leader, Amy Carnevale. It was a squeaker of a vote, 37-34. And when she was gave her little speech there, she took stock of the Mass GOP in recent years. She said they lost, you know, in the race for governor. They had Jeff Deal. Charlie Baker obviously won. They lost thousands, tens of thousands of registered Republicans in the last 4 years. I didn't even know that. And their financial accounts have dwindled down to $35,000. So failing at every count, is the Mass GOP going to fare better under Amy Carnevale?
Yes, 1,000%. So, you know, yeah. Jim Lyons, unfortunately, he is, you know, I called him Losing Lyons. That, you know, that was kind of my nickname for him because the guy couldn't win a single election, including at the end his own. The state parties serve a very specific purpose. Their purpose is to recruit and train candidates, be the messaging machine for those candidates, and essentially be a piggy bank, right? To be able to go and do the fundraising, bring in big names. And what Jim Lyons did while Charlie Baker was governor was probably the most oppressive thing that any party chairman could ever do to any party, which was not use the governor who take Charlie's most popular governor in the country status off the table and just say he was a governor of the same party. You use that governor to help you raise money, to attract candidates, and to inspire voters to vote for your candidates. And he did none of that. And so what I see with Amy, and so I'd like to put Jim Lyons now in the rearview mirror and not talk about him ever again. And I think I was probably the first person to ever talk about Jim Lyons on your radio show when Jim had to explain who the hell this guy was. Mm-hmm. But for Amy, I think it is, you know, the person who's putting out the lifeboats on the Titanic. She is going to get everyone to safety. She's got a lot of work to do with the insurgents, with the folks that really were behind Jim Lyons the whole entire time, and be able to unify the party. But at the end of the day, she's got to bring back those donors and let, you know, pretty much instill faith in them that she's going to correct the course, that she's going to be a good messenger for the party, and eventually be able to inspire winning candidates, or at least potentially winning candidates, to be out there and run for office.
You know,
she's anti-choice and anti-gay, though, I think, Jesse. It's going to be kind of a tough sell, I think, in Massachusetts.
She absolutely is. She's a two-time Donald Trump supporter. She was part of his strategy team in Massachusetts in 2016. Listen, she may be a better strategist to head the Mass GOP and check some of the boxes around fundraising and, you know, organizing. But in terms of being extremist, out of touch, dangerous, not what we need in Massachusetts. Marjorie, you are exactly right. She is not in line with the values of our Commonwealth. She is an extreme far right leader. We'll see whether or not she can right the ship organizationally, but I certainly don't look at her as any more moving in the right direction in terms of the value of the Commonwealth than he whose name shall not be spoken for Jen's mental health.
But you know what? You're missing, though, is that a party leader is not the one running for office. Her views don't matter here, because what matters is that she is going to be the person who's going to help recruit the candidates who are going to be running. And she having, I mean, I've been party chair. I can tell you guys what my own personal views are, but that is very different from my public views, which are, you know, like, I'm not going to tell you what you need to do. I wanted to inspire candidates, good candidates who are going to run for office. And if she just sticks to the message of fiscal responsibility in a state where we just, you know, brought in a new, you know, so-called millionaires tax, where the city of Boston is imposing rent control again, all the other things.
By the way, neither of those things is true, for what it's worth. Democrats did not do the millionaire's tax, Jennifer. The voters did.
No,
and Boston is imposing nothing. The mayor has a topic
union,
on the table.
The teachers union was very instrumental in that effort. And so
that's not a party. That's a union.
No, and I get it. I get it. But I'm saying that there are many voters in Massachusetts with the 56% of unenrolled voters that want someone else. And so
you know, I
think that that's what a party chair's role is to inspire candidates and to be the leader of them and not to give her own opinion on what her personal views are.
I hope
but
that's
fairness,
hey, Jesse.
The most recent party chair saw his job, and
that's
so
correct. That's correct, which is why he's out on his rear end.
But exactly, Jesse, if I may, this may sound small to listeners, but it's not small to me or Marjorie. When we read that the House voted in the last few days, the overwhelmingly Democratic House, to not allow a rules change that would allow the public to know how members of committees actually vote on a damn bill, I said to myself immediately, you know why they did that? Because they have no opposition. And you know when they would stop doing those undemocratic things? If the Republican Party had candidates running against them, they wouldn't have the nerve to say, we're not going to disclose to the public how our members vote on legislation that would affect them. Would you not agree with that?
I don't know if the Republicans' strength plays into that, but I led a rally in Brookline 2 years ago calling for those rules to pass and a number of other transparency rules. I think it's absolutely ridiculous that voters can't look and see how members vote in committee to move things along. I think transparency is essential.
But the Democrats just voted against it. And I'm saying
they
voted against it because they're not worried about their jobs. Because
it is atrocious that they voted against it. I have no problem saying that.
Yeah, and Jesse, one more thing for you about Democrats' challenge. And I hope, by the way, if people are listening now who do care about actually knowing what their elected officials do, the Senate is not involved in this. Call your House member and ask if they voted. It probably was a voice vote, so it's not recorded. If they voted to keep secret their votes on legislation that would affect you and your life. One last question. We had Max Page here, the president of the MTA, the other day. You mentioned the MTA, or Jennifer did a minute ago. Woburn, obviously the five-day strike just ended. The MTA is supporting the elimination of the bar on striking by public employees, except public safety employees. We asked Governor Healey about it the other day. She said she doesn't have a position yet. MTA is arguably the most important force in the Democratic Party. What are Democrats going to do about it? I think Max Page and I may be the only two people who actually support the right to strike of these teachers. I'm serious. It appears to be a minority. What do the Democrats do when their most powerful lobbying force and most powerful supporter says they want to change? Do they walk in step?
So full disclosure, the Mass Teachers Association is a client of mine and my company, okay. not on this
Thank
issue,
you.
Working on public higher education, but I want to be transparent about that. Listen, there are plenty of legislators who are inside the building pushing for the right to strike for teachers, folks like Mark Pacheco, Becca Rausch, and others. So there is certainly strong support in the Democratic Party for the right to strike. I'm with you, Jim. I think it's important, particularly as we watch educators fleeing their profession in the wake of the COVID crisis. We need to make sure they understand that that they have a place to speak out in the most extreme of circumstances when they don't feel like they've being heard. But this isn't the only ask that the MTA has this session. They're going to go to bat. They're going to fight for this. But there are many, many other pieces of their legislative priority. So I think it's too soon to say whether or not this is some sort of commentary on where the MTA stands with the Democratic Party. It's been a huge, huge, important partnership for years and years. And I think that's just going to continue to grow and strengthen.
You know, Jesse and Jennifer. I'm sorry, we're out of time.
Are we out of time? I can't see the clock.
No, you can't. I'll move the mic. I'm sorry, you can't see it. But, you know, as a favor to both of you, since you were terrific, on the way out, as Marjorie says goodbye, we're going to play George Santos singing Hallelujah at a karaoke. So
I didn't know you hated us, Jim.
Can we cue that, please, while Marjorie thanks our guests for their excellent participation? Thank you, guys, both of you.
Thank you very much. We've been speaking with
That's good, actually. Oh, that is fine.
Okay, enough of that. Good. Jesse Mermel and Jennifer Nassar, thank you very much. Jesse Mermel is founder and president of DeWitt Impact Group, former Democratic candidate for Congress in Massachusetts, 4th Congressional District. Jennifer Nassar is the founder of the Pocketbook Project, former chair of the Massachusetts Republican Party, and former candidate for Boston City Council. Up next, Massachusetts casinos just launched sports betting last week. We'll speak with the State Gaming Commission on all the rules of the game. Coming up next, you're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
I'm Jim Browdy, head on Boston Public Radio. We're a week into the era of legal sports betting in Massachusetts. We'll talk about how it's going with Kathy Judd Stein. She's head of the Massachusetts Gaming Commission. Plus, the advent of online sports betting is only a week away. We'll get into that, too. Then a look at the climate fights in our own backyard, including on Cape Cod, where water is being polluted virtually everywhere. Bradley Campbell from the Conservation Law Foundation joins us.
I'm Marjorie Yeagan. What can a $1 billion ad campaign for Jesus do for his brand? We'll ask the Reverend Zahia Monroe and Emma G. Price III before turning to a conversation about maternal mental health with Mass Postpartum Depression Fund founder Jesse Colbert and Dr. Lena Mittal from Brigham and Women's. Then, how long do you have to wait before ditching your dud of a date? We'll open the lines, phones, and text lines and ask you all that ahead. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Yeagan. You're listening to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again, Marjorie. So sports betting, as you know, is now legal and happening in Massachusetts after a years-long political campaign to get it approved and months of regulatory review. We're joined by now by the Gaming Commission, the Massachusetts Gaming Commission, Chair Kathy Judd Stein, to discuss what to expect when you step through the doors of one of the state's casinos looking to place a bet, and when you can legally bet from the smartphone on your couch. Chair Judd Stein, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie. Thanks for having me and letting me represent the Gaming Commission and my fellow commissioners.
We're really glad to have
you. Well, we're very happy to have you here. So just give us an overview. How's it going so far? Are people betting like mad?
Well, as you know, we launched retail sports wagering last Tuesday, January 31st, meeting our deadline. And since that time, things have been going well. I met this morning briefly with the division chief, Bruce Bann, who comes with a ton of experience. And he said it's been a busy last few days. And in terms of revenues, stay tuned. We'll be probably reporting that out after the 15th of the month, just as we do with casino revenue.
You know, the tentative date, from what I understand, for online sports gambling is somewhere around March 1st. So essentially, the brick-and-mortar betting establishments had a month head start. I should know the answer to this, and my apologies for even asking it. Is Was that decision about timing made to give a head start to the casinos? Because the history around the country, correct me if I'm wrong, is that ultimately there'll be much more betting online than there is in the actual casino? Or was that just a logistical necessity?
Well, it's actually a really good question. And we had a little process around that question, Jim. We met, we had several round tables where we got intelligence from different stakeholders. And we met with the potential online sports operators around a couple issues. And one was, how do you feel if we did decide to launch retail in, ahead of online? And you're right. We could look at other jurisdictions to say that that's kind of a smart move. We knew the three licensees who would be launching for the retail. And so that gave us a relationship to build from. And what we learned from the online sports operators that they were good with that. I think with the exception of maybe one or two, they were all good with that. It allows us to launch, get going, find out if there are any concerns, and then we could prepare for the online, which would take a little bit longer. There are more players, and we wanted to be timely and be able to take advantage of some good sporting events in February.
Well, a big sporting event in February, of course, is coming up this weekend, the Super Bowl. So if people want to bet on that, is it still the casinos, or what's between now and Sunday?
Right. Tibet on the Super Bowl, you can go to one of the three casinos, Plainridge Park Casino in Plainville, MGM Springfield in Springfield, Mass., and then, of course, Encore Boston Harbor in Everett. And the sports books are available for you to place your wager on the Super Bowl. You don't need to go to one of the neighboring states. You can stay right here in Massachusetts and place those bets. And enjoy the benefit of our game sense advisors who are there on site to give some hints about how sports wagering works and how to do it responsibly and how to do it with information that will be really manage your play and your interests.
We're talking to Kathy Judd-Stein, who's the chair of the Massachusetts Gaming Commission. We want to talk to you quite a bit in a minute about how we do our best to ensure that people do gamble responsibly, which has always been my concern. I just have one more question about the casino licenses. Early on, I think you and your colleagues correctly, at least in my opinion, raised concerns about Plainville because of their association with Barstools and Barstool Sports and their leader, David Portnoy, a Massachusetts native, who I think was in a New York Times piece, described himself as a degenerative gambler. How did you, and obviously we're concerned, I guess, about the impact or the potential influence of Barstool Sports vis-a-vis a license there. How did you overcome the concerns, you and your colleagues, Chair Judd-Stein?
Well, that's also a very good question, and one that the commission took a lot of time thinking about. First, I want to make sure folks understand that PPC, Plainridge Park Casino, has been a very responsible casino operator. Recently, it was relicensed by the Gaming Commission after we did a thorough review and investigation of its first 5 years of work. And the Plainville community was very supportive of the partnership that they've established with Plainridge Park Casino and all of the benefits, particularly as an economic driver there for that community and the surrounding community. So we had, I just want to note that, and PPC is owned by Penn Entertainment. About a couple of years ago, Penn Entertainment was reevaluating its business model and apparently decided to make the decision to invest in Barstool Sports. It's a 36% investment, which my understanding will become a 100% ownership of this fund. The one important element to understand here is that it's a complex corporate governance structure. And the way that it's structured, the influencers, the independent contractors, the employees of Barstool Sportsbook, the media company, doesn't have any control over sports wagering. So our Investigations and Enforcement Bureau, IEB, isn't able to do the same kind of investigation of those individuals in the entity that it would normally do, because they're not what we you know as qualifiers. So with that restriction, the Gaming Commission did say, however, and because of that New York Times article and because of our concern, particularly around Mr. Portnoy perhaps glamorizing excessive gambling, and we wanted to make sure that the message was sent in Massachusetts, you've got to prioritize responsible gaming and the health and welfare of our bettors. With that, we conditioned the temporary licensure on an investigation of the branding arrangement, the marketing arrangement, which would allow our IEB to look at those relationships and ensure that this branding element is going to prioritize the values that the Gaming Commission cares about. And what was good, Jim, is that Penn Entertainment actually suggested the investigation, and they were really agreeing to that condition, one that we have imposed that temporary licensure, and we'll find out more as our IEB works toward the durable suitability investigation.
We're talking with Massachusetts Gaming Commission Chair Kathy Judstein. So you mentioned the precautions that Massachusetts wants to take involving people losing everything in gambling. So what kind of precautions are you talking about?
Well, again, one thing I learned is that my fellow commissioners and I, we work and do our work in public, and we work on a virtual platform. And so we're learning things together, and we are all united around the paramount concern of protecting the health and well-being of Massachusetts bettors. And so we're really lucky in Massachusetts that the legislature endowed the Gaming Commission with resources so that we can do innovations. I think I've spoken with you before about our GameSense program, which is on-site and available for those who are gambling on-site at our retail sportsbook as well as our casinos. They're also available for online and phone help as well.
What does that mean? What does that mean that they're on-site? That you see them when you are exiting or coming out of the men's room or the women's room or something? What does that mean?
Well, actually, that's fair. We actually have at each site a GameSense information center. And right now for the sportsbook, you'll see some really great looking striped, I think it's green and black, or green, I think green and black rather than green and navy, shirts that have a sporting feel. And those folks are deployed by statute on the casino floor, on the sportsbook floor, to be able to answer questions, to help folks who are in distress or asking questions that could range from where is the men's room, or could I have a bottle of water, to how does this sports wagering work, and how can I also set limits on what I want to bet, how I can set limits, and this will be true with also online and in your device, how I can cool off momentarily for a bit, how I can set limits on the time I'm on the device. Mm-hmm. And then most importantly, our voluntary self-exclusion program, which we also extended to sports wagering. And that program allows a gambler, casino gambler, or someone who's a sports wagerer to self-impose a cooling off period where they cannot bet. Their name is put on a list. And the duration is self-imposed as well, 1 to 3 to 5 years. And for those who have already engaged in a self-exclusion, they can actually do a lifetime exclusion. That's very well run through our GameSense program and through our research and response gaming program here.
I want to stay on those protections, Kathy Judstein, if we can, for a second. Just a couple of quick answers. My understanding is, at a casino, if you do the sports betting, it's got to be in cash. Is that correct?
Oh, no credit.
No credit. Absolutely. And at home, no credit, debit cards, et cetera. Those are all good things. But this voluntary exclusion thing, I don't really know anything except what I've read about people who have gambling addictions or gambling problems. But it seems to me common sense that the last person who would ask for a temporary or multi-year exclusion is a person who's got a problem. Somebody like me, who does not have a problem, may say, can you limit me to $100 tonight? It's sort of like a dinner out, and I'll just have a fun entertainment kind of night. But somebody who's got a problem, how likely is it they're going to come and say to whatever that entity is called that you talked about, please help, please protect me from myself? You know what I mean?
Well, I do. And it's interesting because I think, first off, the voluntary self-exclusion program is actually one that is employed across the country and around the world. So there's familiarity. We have already on our program, there since 2013, there are more than 1,700 people have enrolled for voluntary self-exclusion at our casino. And even before we started sports wagering, I know we extended the program to that. And I think almost instantly we had an individual who said, I need to exclude. So it is awareness. And we provide awareness through our Game Sense program and information about how to self-exclude or to set those limits that you mentioned. It's an education. And I'll tell you, Jim, we will stay on this. I think one of our research initiatives will be extending a look at behavioral impacts. So it's also something we study closely.
We're talking to Kathy Judd-Stein. She's chair of the Massachusetts Gaming Commission.
You know, one of the things I read, and you can fill me in on this, is that we're not just talking about necessary sports. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff we're going to be able to bet on now in Massachusetts. So like what?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the statute does allow for the Gaming Commission to extend some exercise discretion and make available other than sporting or sporting events that we're more familiar with. One might call the hot dog eating contest a sporting event of sorts.
If you've never watched it, you'd consider it a sporting event.
Oh, used to cover them every 4th of July in East Boston. It was like 90 degrees and people stuffing sausages down their gullets.
This is Nathan's on July 4th. It doesn't get much
worse
than
Nathan's.
That. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Kathy Judson.
No, that's okay. I'm laughing because it tickled us too, but we got kind of comfortable with it because it's clear metrics. You know, you can count hot dogs, you can measure hot dogs. So that's included. We also did extend in our catalog the ability for folks to bet on the awards, the Emmys and the Academy Awards and those types of programs. Those were based on requests made by the three casinos. We asked them to give us their best case for a catalog of events. And we really were able to justify including what they recommend and they wished, except for a few exceptions. And one does have to do with those sporting events that are judged or determined, I should say, decided by either a single judge or a panel of judges. We're looking at that more closely, particularly in the Olympic sports. We also decided not to have cornhole. Sorry.
What is cornhole? I read that.
Cornhole?
I don't even know what it is.
You're kidding.
Jim,
oh
you don't
my
know
God.
What cornhole is.
No, and I'm proud that I don't. What is it?
People will play for hours. Yeah. No, I mean, my kids, it's huge. And sometimes you go to public beaches now, and they have all these cornhole games, so you can play it on the sand.
Okay, well, one of you two let me in. What is it?
We could play a trick on what it is and say it has to do with eating, you know, some kind of corn. But it's, you know, you've seen it. The game where you take a bean bag and you toss it across the way into a wooden structure with holes in it, and you get certain points.
Exactly.
I'm pretty good at that, Margie. I don't know how you.
There you go.
There.
Well, you know, Kathy, when you mentioned the Emmys and the Academy Awards, I was also thinking to myself, they have been struggling, you know, in the ratings. I mean, they don't do as well as they used to. Neither do last night's Grammys, unless something changed last night. So this could be a whole new life. It might be a lot more fun watching the Emmys and the Academy Awards if you could bet on who's going to win Best Picture. But Jim, I think you have you could have a talent too. You and
Cornhole?
Kathy. Could get out there and do the cornhole thing. Absolutely.
I don't think she's allowed to, probably, but I'll be doing it soon.
No.
You know,
no, you're not, by the way. You are not allowed to. Can you go even into a casino?
We do go into the casinos for work only, and because we are the regulators, we need to visit. In fact, all commissioners visited all three casinos on launch day on Tuesday. We started out at MGM Springfield, made our way to PPC, and then ended up at Encore. you know, so that we could congratulate the leadership and the staff there and our own staff that are deployed on the casino floors. And we got to see the activity and feel pretty good about the work that was done to get to that January 31st launch.
But you can't go sit at the blackjack table because you're a commissioner.
Oh, no. And if I'm given a training, believe me, we have people who know that we're there strictly for business. Marjorie, we can't even eat at the restaurants.
Oh.
Even if we pay the market price when we're out there. So we have to pack a sandwich when we go.
Yeah, but that pales next to not being able to bet on cornhole, whatever that is. So
No betting.
Kathy Judd-Stein, who again is chair of the Gaming Commission, just implemented sports betting. Can we get back to briefly? I mentioned that we're roughly 3 weeks away, according to what I've read about your commission, from online gambling, sports betting being allowed. When will we have a firm date, and what is the determinant about when that date should be?
So, yes, we haven't set that date yet, and I have been working with our executive director to be able to give clarity about the work that needs to be done for the launch. So she's working backwards. You know, there's still some good work that needs to be done, and we have 11 temporary licensees who need to be tested, everything from their technical platform and their cybersecurity, geofencing. They also have to give us their internal controls for approval as well as their house rules. So there's work to be done. And our technical experts, GLI, have a good amount of work to do. So I think that Executive Director Karen Wells, who's done such a superb job with the entire team, is looking at, you know, that first week of March, but she knows that everyone's asking for the exact date. We are on target to make our deadline and hope that we can, you know, have those folks who want to bet online be able to participate in March Madness.
Yeah, you know, Kathy Judd-Stein, I'm in the minority in Massachusetts. The voters had an opportunity to speak on the legalization of casinos and that sort of thing. I'm in the minority. I don't like it, and the reason I don't like it is I think I've told you before, I'm not crazy about the state relying to the extent we do on gambling and people losing money to fund. I know that's not your bailiwick, by the way. Obviously, that's a legislative thing and the voters on the ballot. But I'm curious if you have statistics. I mentioned the late Tom Birmingham, who just died a few weeks ago, former Senate president, and did a report a bunch of years ago, and there's updates of this that show that on the lottery, for example, we bet more. The people, every man, woman, and child in Massachusetts bets more by a huge amount than the second most intense lottery betting state in the country. It's stunning how distant number two is. I think it's D.C. I'm not sure. Whatever it is, a big gap. Are we the same on things like casinos? Do we beat the lower 49, or are we more sort of in the middle here? Where do we rank in terms of casino betting?
Well, I don't know if I have the exact quote-unquote propensity determinant that you're looking for. I have heard the same with respect to the lottery. First off, I do need to clarify that children are not allowed to place bets.
No, I know. I'm sorry, but that's how they compute. It's every person in the state. I'm glad you made that clarification.
Yeah, no one under 21 can place a wager or be on the gaming floor in any casino. So I don't have that. I do know that you know, Massachusetts has been looked at as a state where there could be a propensity to bet, and we have a study from UMass that indicates that 20% of Massachusetts adults were already engaged in sports wagering. Mm-hmm. So, and there's also some indicators, Jim, that with the onset of sports wagering comes the perhaps an increase in problem gambling. So, you know, you're right to have those concerns, and then of course the argument that the lawmakers and the governor who signed the bill also recognize that with regulation comes those tools that can serve as protectors, that can provide consumer protection. And that's what we focus on. We are implementing sports wagering as the legislature asked us to. We're doing it with the highest level of integrity and the highest level of consumer protections. And we have, top of mind, exactly the concerns you're raising. And we're going to monitor the compliance. Right now, the licensees that we evaluated, they're all indicating that they have the same high level of commitment to responsible gaming as we do. But you're absolutely right. Okay. Massachusetts has been, there's been that suggestion. And of course, we also, for sports, have a great sports history, which makes the market.
Sure. So before you go, if I'm in touch with your office, I assume you and I can go do some cornhole someday. Is that correct?
You know, I
did you see the picture, Jim?
I did. I want to hear what the chair has to say here, though.
Oh, I'm sorry. Were you asking Margie?
No, I don't want to play with Margie. I want to play with you.
You know what? I welcome the opportunity to set up a beach cornhole with you, Jim. That would be a lot of fun.
A dream come true is what you meant to say.
I hear a dream come true.
The commissioner has a mean underhand. That's what I hear.
Kathy Judd-Stein, we really appreciate your time. We'll hope to see you again soon. Thanks so much for time today.
Thanks
for being with us. Appreciate it. We've been speaking with the chair of the Gaming Commission, Kathy Judd-Stein, and we thank her again for taking the time. Up next, Conservation Law Foundation, President Bradley Campbell. We're going to talk about electric cars with him and the pollution choking Cape Cod's fresh and ocean water, which is so upsetting. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GPH. Bradley Campbell's next.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she's Marjorie Egan. We're joined now on Zoom by Bradley Campbell. He's the president and CEO of the Conservation Law Foundation. Brad, it's good to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
Yeah, thanks so much, Brad, for being with us. So you guys ran a big full-page ad in the Boston Globe just a few days ago talking about Cape Cod. What did the ad warn us about?
Well, clean water is really the driver of everything we love about the Cape. It drives its economy. It's what makes it a natural treasure and the place that people want to live and vacation. And we're really at a crisis in terms of water pollution on the Cape, where untreated wastewater is fouling the Cape's bays, and it's time to act. And in fact, action is overdue. And we're very encouraged that the Department of Environmental Protection came forth with a sensible set of rules to begin to reduce the pollution going into the bays. But they are not a one-size-fits-all solution. They give each town flexibility to design its program, but they're overdue. They're much needed. You know, they're not as they don't require action as quickly as environmental groups like mine would like to see. But they're certainly the right step in the right direction in terms of reducing the pollution and protecting what we love about the Cape.
Brad, could you go spend a minute going a little more deeply into what the cause of this is? I assume part of it is climate change, but obviously that's I assume it's only a part of it. Could you explain in a little more detail what the other human septic tank sewage cause of this thing is, please?
Sure. The climate change does play a role because the waters are typically warmer, which is the perfect environment for algae to bloom. But humans are contributing to it through discharges of waste. And specifically, some of it comes from inadequately treated sewage from sewage treatment plants. A lot of it comes from septics, which by and large aren't designed to control for nitrogen. And nitrogen is the pollutant in this case that's really causing these algae blooms, that's fouling the waters of the Cape, diminishing the quality of the Cape and its waters and affecting property values.
Well, you know, the headline of the New York Times, which was so upsetting, was a toxic stew on Cape Cod, human waste and warming water. And it talked about, you know, cyanobacteria, which means you can't swim if it's bad enough in the water. You have a house on a lake and you can't swim in it. And the already kettle ponds all over Cape Cod have been shut down. And cyanobacteria will kill your dogs, which is another great thing to think about. And you also talk about the oceans in this. But what I'm wondering is if you upgrade septic systems, which seems like a great idea. As you know, there's a lot of sewage. There's some sewage pipes going into Cape Cod, thanks in part to that wind farm that's out in Martha's Vineyard. There's sewage treatment going down through the streets in Centerville. I was just down there yesterday. I could see all these huge pipes. But I think a lot of people are afraid, well, if I upgrade my septic system, am I then going to have to pay for the sewage to come in, you know, 5 years, 10 years down the road?
Is that a question on your own behalf or on behalf of the people of Cape Cod, by the way?
Well, I was just down in Cape Cod with someone that was pretty hysterical about this.
So, was she related to you or not?
Yeah, okay. Worried about having to do both the septic and the sewage.
Well, your reference to a toxic stew is spot on, as was the New York Times. And there has been a lot of talk about the cost and the burden of these rules. And it's actually one of the reasons why it's important that DEP finalize these rules now, because there's once in a lifetime funding available from the federal government, there's funding available from the state government, and there are all these different pieces of funding that may not be there if action is further delayed. And with respect to the cost, I think DEP has brought forward a very reasonable approach, which is they have kind of a backstop rule for those towns that don't act. But towns that act, that take leadership on this issue and design a program that gets to the end point of cleaner waters, can pace their compliance and enter an individualized permit, essentially a watershed permit, DEP is calling it, so that they can take into account the economics, take into account the funding that's available, and really time their investments to address that.
What about, I mean, septic tanks cost a lot of money. Obviously, a lot of people that live down the Cape don't have a lot of money. So is this going to be, how will people pay for this, the individual homeowners?
Well, that's both where the flexibility of the DEP rules come in and this available funding comes in. There is money available at the state level. There is money forthcoming at the federal level under both the infrastructure law and the recently passed Inflation Reduction Act. It really makes it the moment that the Cape needs to get its arms around this problem, in addition to the fact that the pollution is becoming so bad and it's reached such a crisis point that it needs to be addressed.
But I guess what I'm wondering, will individual homeowners have to shell out $25,000, or will the town, you know, how will they afford it?
Essentially, there's a combination of funding streams that can be brought to bear, including funding at the state level, and we'll continue to fight for that funding. But also, in any given case, it'll be, for each town, it may be a different balance of septic upgrades versus hooking, adding people to central wastewater treatment plants. And that's why it's important that towns take the lead, work with DEP on these watershed permits so they can get moving and time those investments when they make sense.
You know, just staying on this just for a couple more minutes. I'm reading, I'm embarrassed to say, I knew so little about this. I see your ad in the Globe, I think it was on January 29th, and then I started reading about this. Is Pompanesset how you pronounce that word,
Pompanesset?
Okay. Well, I was Pompanesset. Listen to this. And this is in the New York Times. And the average August water temperature in Pompanesset Bay jumped from 68.2 degrees Fahrenheit in 2007 to 76.5 degrees this year. 8 degrees in 16 years. I mean, I don't know if you've done it. I know there's deep concern about cost. I mean, I think that's why Marjorie's asking the question you're attempting to address. But is there a consensus? Do they understand at what crisis level this thing is, or is this like almost everything else we do in this state, which is let's kick the can down the road, whether it's the tea or whatever the hell else it is? What's the mindset of the average Cape person, if you know, Brad Campbell?
I think the mindset is a lot of concern about costs, which Marjorie reflected, but also a history. There's been a history of kicking the can down the road, just as you say. I mean, when they first, CLF first sued to compel the cleanup of Boston Harbor, nobody wanted to pay then. It was an open sewer for years because the legislature never wanted to appropriate the money. That's true again here. And, you know, there was an agreement with EPA 8 years ago on what the plan should be to clean up these waters. Very little has happened since. And people, again, have had the experience that they can just kick the can down the road. What we've seen, and this is a great example of it, it only gets more expensive if you wait to address pollution. And so now is the time to do it when there's more funding available. Because as you described, Jim, we have between climate warming and the incredible growth on the Cape that's adding to these nitrogen burdens, you have the perfect petri dish for awful algae blooms.
You know, Brad, you didn't mention fertilizer, and I think it's more to people that are close to the water, but my understanding is that fertilizing lawns that are on the water is a huge problem, too, especially when you have those torrential rains and the runoff, and that one of the reasons some of the lakes did better last summer, because it was a drought, and it didn't rain as much, and the fertilizer didn't get into the lakes.
Fertilizer can be a problem as well. It's not the primary driver of the problem, but it certainly is a contributing factor. In EPA's studies, they've really identified the wastewater as the central contributor to the algae that we're seeing on the Cape.
You know, Brad Campbell, who runs the Conservation Law Foundation, when you just mentioned the suits that led to the cleanup of Boston Harbor, I realize we shouldn't assume that particularly either new people to town or younger listeners know the history of CLF. It generally, I hope you're not offended by this, but it's either lawsuits or threatened lawsuits that you guys are famous for that often provokes epiphanies on the part of public officials. Could you spend a minute and just describe to people what CLF is and is done, Brad Campbell?
Well, we're an environmental advocacy organization. We've been in covering New England for more than 55 years, and we do hold both polluters and governments accountable when they don't comply with the law. In the case of the Cape, it's the Clean Water Act primarily, mm-hmm. and also the state regulations. And we have many tools in our toolbox in terms of advocacy, from market measures to working with scientists and regulations. But when push comes to shove and when people aren't moving, towns and state governments aren't moving forward to implement the law, lawsuits are often necessary. And this is the quintessential example. Mm-hmm. And one of how that intersects with the cost and these regulations is that it, understandably, if you're an elected official, it's really hard to be pushing for implementation of solutions when other towns aren't being held to that standard. And one central importance of the Department of Environmental Protection coming forward with these rules is it really sets a template so that all the towns are being held accountable, even though within the rule, they can craft the plan to their particular needs.
Understood. Talking to Bradley Campbell, President and CEO of the Conservation Law Foundation.
Well, let's move off from Cape Cod. Talk about how we have a new governor now who said she's going to climate is going to be one of her big causes. But we also have continuing construction of electric substations and new gas pipelines. There was this Pecker project out in, is it Springfield? I think the people are, Pecker plant, where's the Pecker plant? I think it's Springfield. So we seem to be continuing to build fossil fuel stations. And Governor Baker, I remember, said repeatedly that we can't convert yet to clean energy because we need these in terms of high energy costs days in the summertime when it's really hot or the winter time when it's really cold, like last weekend. So what's the deal with building these new pipelines and electric substations? One is in East Boston, I should have said.
Well, there's a distinction between the fossil fuel infrastructure, the natural gas pipelines and new plants, and the substation that's in East Boston. There are always substations. They're not, they can be needed for clean energy as well as dirty energy. And the controversy in East Boston in particular is really about how Eversource went about it in terms of siting the substation. There was a backroom deal with Mayor Walsh where a parcel that otherwise would have been parkland was transferred to Eversource. And a real contrast between how Eversource sited substation in, for example, in Central Square, in Kendall there, they had a proposed substation. They got a complaint from the city manager and they worked with the community and worked with the city to find an alternative location that was more acceptable to the community. In East Boston, they not only had calls from the mayor, but they had calls from a lot of elected officials, plus a public referendum where an overwhelming majority of Bostonians said in a non-binding referendum that they didn't want the substation where it was. In spite of all of that, there's been no effort to explore alternatives. And in fact, they're plowing ahead with construction and having residents who are in protesting arrested.
Have you sued them yet?
Yeah, among other advantages that the utilities have in the siting process, they've gotten an approval to basically sidestep over a dozen permitting requirements. And there is a challenge to that is currently or about to come before the Supreme Judicial Court where we are involved.
You know, by the way,
I just want to say the Peaker plan is not in Springfield.
It's in Peabody. I want to get to that in a second. By the way, Brad has co-wrote a piece in the Globe this morning about Kendall Square versus East Boston. Again, this morning's Boston Globe. Marjorie, almost every month that Charlie Baker was here, or maybe every other month for the last year, has gotten a little tiff with him about the Peaker plan in Peabody. And Marjorie, correct me if I'm wrong. What Baker's response generally is it's only going to be used a couple hundred hours a year.
Yes,
it is purely when there's a peak demand.
It's a natural gas and oil burning facility.
Right. So his contention was he didn't put it dismissively like this. Don't worry so much about it. It's going to be limited use and only when there's an emergency need. And assuming I accurately describe what the former governor's position is, what's wrong with that position, if anything, Brad Campbell?
Well, what's wrong with it is we generally shouldn't be investing in additional fossil fuel infrastructure at this point when we have state laws that are mandating that we transition off of fossil fuels. So I have to side with Marjorie on this one. And, you know, just to give you a sense, peaker plants, the reason we need peaker plants is right now the peak demand is roughly twice what the average demand for electricity is. There are so many things the utilities could be doing to lower the peak, use of storage, use of better pricing structures for time of use, and more deployment of energy efficiency. That's really the challenge we should be addressing, is reducing that peak rather than building new fossil fuel facilities to address the peak, because the entire incentive structure for the utilities is to increase that peak. That's when prices are highest.
Of course.
And of course, they're responding to that incentive. And the administration, particularly the Baker administration, really didn't respond to that challenge.
Is there an alternative, though, in timely fashion? I understand in big picture fashion, I totally subscribe to your notion about alternative methods and alternative sources of energy. But if Baker was right about the need in the current environment where the utilities aren't doing what you suggest they could do to reduce peak need, is there an alternative to something like what's happening in Peabody?
We think there is. One of the challenges of the siting process, one reason the siting process needs reform generally, is there's a very low bar for the utilities in showing that something is needed. And because they get a guaranteed return on whatever capital investments they make, there's a real incentive for them to build more than is necessary, to overbuild, essentially.
Brad Campbell, I wanted to ask you before you go about electric cars. Brad Campbell, by the way, is the president and CEO of the Conservation Law Foundation. Jim is setting an example for us all. He's got his new Tesla and he's driving
You don't have
around.
To say it's a Tesla every time, Marjorie. Why can't you just say Jim just bought an EV rather than emphasizing a Tesla every
okay,
time?
Okay, well, because
I do have an EV. That is correct.
Wouldn't have a certain je ne sais quoi if I didn't put it in the Tesla.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate
it. But in any case, we're reading more and more now about a concern that if everybody just switches over to EV cars and they end up being these Ford 150s or these huge, like Escalade-sized Cadillacs or something, the battery is going to have to be so big that it's going to require massive mining of lithium, and lithium creates terrible environmental problems. So what about that, and where should we be on these EVs and the lithium?
There's much to be said for the fact that we're building many of the EVs or sort of following the trend line that we've had over the past couple of decades of larger and larger vehicles, and it does result in a need for not only more lithium, but also more electricity to charge them. So it's problematic in that respect. Ultimately, I think we're going to need to provide all of the car companies with incentive to build more compact vehicles, lighter vehicles, to address that issue. Where the trend line is not going in the right direction now, but I think with the right incentive structures, it could. I mean, just by way of example, I don't think that the either in the electric category or other categories, the big three are really planning to make many sedans. I think Ford is now at a point where they're not making any sedans, which are a more compact way of traveling. So it is really a challenge in terms of both on the lithium side and on the power demand side. But in any event, it's better to be in an electric F-150 than in a fossil fuel powered one.
I just like to say, well, I can't remember what brand of EV I have. I can't tell you that I have the smallest model made by that particular
right.
company. Hey, Brad Campbell, before you go, can we go back to, back to the electric, whatever it's called, substation in East Boston, the peaker plant, et cetera. Governor Healey has talked a lot about being the first governor in the country to pick a climate chief to sort of oversee almost everything is done. She mentioned it to us the other day when she was with us at the library. What are the two or three concrete things that you believe the governor has power to do that she should be doing immediately that would indicate that the rhetoric, I don't mean that disrespectfully, the rhetoric is matched by action. What should she be doing?
Well, we've been encouraged by what we've seen so far, and she appointed a terrific climate chief who's actually a CLF alumna.
But, oh, really?
Yeah, Melissa Hoffer, years ago, led our environmental justice efforts in our New Hampshire office. But what needs to happen now is exactly what didn't happen during 8 years of the Baker administration, which is they need to come forward with rules that implement the climate laws that have been in place for a long time and that have been strengthened twice over the course of the Baker administration. The only major rules the Baker administration came forward with on climate came about because CLF filed a lawsuit and got the Supreme Judicial Court to declare that, yes, they were under an obligation to issue those rules. Mm. Time is running out, and it's really important, especially given how long the rulemaking process takes, that the administration move on implementing the law. And that those, I know you asked for three places.
No, but, it doesn't have to be three. Yep.
Those rules encompass, you know, it's a law, a climate law that applies to all sectors of the economy. So they apply to the Department of Transportation, the Department of Environmental Protection, and so forth. And so they need to begin that process, and they need to do it while also being very cognizant of equity and the distribution of burdens for communities that really bear the most climate risk, the most pollution.
Like East Boston, for example, in
yes.
this case.
Like East Boston.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I see Boston.
Brad, we really
Thank
appreciate
you so
your
much.
Time. That was great. Thank you so
for
much.
For coming in and helping
Thanks
us
so
out.
Much.
Good to
Thank
see you.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Brad Campbell. He's president and CEO of the Conservation Law Foundation. Coming up, It's time for All Revved Up on Boston Public Radio. The Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett G. Price are going to join us, and they're going to get to the bottom of whether or not Jesus did get us, and if so, do we need a $1 billion ad campaign to convince everyone, including, of course, in the Super Bowl this Sunday. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Trusted. Local. News. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, HD1 Boston, online at gbhnews.org. GBH News with NPR. What matters to you.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Marjorie Egan, Jim Browdy. We're now joined by Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett G. Price III. Irene is a syndicated religion columnist, Boston voice for Detour's African American Heritage Trail. Emmett is the founding pastor of the Community of Love Christian Fellowship in Allston and the inaugural dean of Africana Studies at Berklee College of Music. And together, of course, they host the great All Revved Up podcast. Welcome to you both.
Hey, glad to be here.
Great to talk to you, as always. So let's start with the $1 billion ad campaign to promote Jesus Christ. He Gets Us is the name of the ad, and we're going to play a little one of the little spots from this campaign. This one's called Outrage.
There was this controversial figure. Everywhere he went, people challenged him. They questioned his ideology, trolled him, called him ugly names. But he never took the bait. Never raised his voice, refused to retaliate, because he believed he could change the world by turning the other cheek.
Count me in.
So, Emmett, I guess one of these He Gets Us ads is going to play in the Super Bowl. They've been playing around the country. The billionaire co-founder of Hobby Lobby, they were very much opposed to birth control in that Supreme Court decision, and other people are behind this ad. What do you think of it?
Well, you know, the first time I saw it, Marjorie, I got sick to my stomach, and my reflection was, wow, no wonder folks don't want to be Christians anymore. it's absolutely ludicrous. Jesus actually did raise his voice. Jesus actually did get upset and angry at the discrimination, prejudice, and a lot of the things that were going on during his day. And then, of course, you have to lead to which Jesus are we reflecting on? Because in American Christianity today, there are about three or four or five different Jesuses. And then who is it, us, right? who does this reflect? So, you know, I was sick to my stomach, and I really wish they would take this off. And there's other ways we can use that $1 billion in this great nation of ours.
But Emmett, you don't have to worry about it because you won't be watching it anyway. But I definitely
that's a very
won't be
good
watching it. You know. But I'm going to tell you about it. But you know, again, I had to laugh at it, looking at it, because it's another form of Christian nationalism, and ads fits right into it. It's a way to keep Christ and they're evangelizing front and center. We got to realize the issue around, you know, Jesus is no longer front and center with so many of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, not the N-U-N-E-S, although I think they should leave too, leaving the church here. And so they're repackaging Jesus. They're trying to make him relevant, give him a human side to it. And the reason for it, again, it's that they're not reaching Emmett, me, and Jim, they're definitely not trying to reach you because you're an agnostic, so we can't, you're sitting on the fence. But they're trying to get people who are somewhat okay about religion, but has problems today because it stands on social issues like LGBT rights, certainly like abortion rights, and also given their sort of ambitious political drive, to change, you know, laws in this country. So they're going for that particular demographic group here. And that's a huge group that will be watching.
You know what, though, you guys, I thought this is a refreshing new Jesus, because mostly these days we see Jesus on Trump banners in front of the January 6th catalog. We hear about Jesus is anti-gay, anti-abortion, anti-birth control, anti-women in a lot of ways, all these things. This, I mean, I looked at about seven of these ads. There's a lot of feeding the people, helping the poor, curing the poor. Jesus is a refugee. I thought it was getting much more back to the Jesus that you read about in the New Testament, instead of this, you know, the white evangelicals talking about Jesus as their hero as they attack the Capitol.
Emmett,
well, you know, one of the things about Jesus of the New Testament. He did not need a marketing or PR campaign, because
that's
people
right.
who experienced him, you know, really felt his love and really felt the sensitivity, compassion, and kindness. And they went around and told everybody they didn't need to spend $1 billion in order to create a campaign, right? So,
yeah.
So if we're going to reflect on the Jesus of the New Testament, we don't need to make it a those who have get to define the narrative. For those who don't have.
Yeah, but can I tell you something?
Wait.
Irene, if I may, I mean, you correctly, in this foursome, and I've said this regularly, I'm the agnostic in the group. And, you know, if the ads from what I read about this, I like this a lot. If your goal is to crack people's mind open, if it talks about him being a social justice revolutionary, championing the rights of the poor, on and on, I don't think it gets anybody, the whole nine yards, but I think Marjorie is right. You're shaking your head, Irene. Let me just get this out, and then you can tell me how foolish I am. People's perspective, most people like me who are only paying attention in recent years know Jesus, as Marjorie says, through the eyes of the loudest voices, Donald Trump, the white evangelicals who support him, etc. If they paint a different picture that's an honest picture, I would say that's – I don't know if they should spend $1 billion. It could probably be better spent,
well,
but
Jim,
some money on the – what?
Jesus said, the poor are always with us,
well,
when Judas criticized him for spending all the money
part.
And the perfume. And the,
yeah,
and the,
well,
so isn't there some value? I mean, isn't there some
– No.
Why no?
There isn't any for a couple of reasons. One, I just want to disabuse all of you who are listening. Those of us who go to seminary, we're still looking for the historical Jesus. So what Jesus, you're saying, this is a better Jesus, that too would be packaging. But the problem is that when we're talking about the NFL, similarly as we were talking about football at a high school, that's neutral space. That leaves out, it's really offensive to people who have are no faith, people who don't want religion in the middle of their football game. I mean, one of the things that I thought really brought Americans together was football, more so than the church did. And so that to me should be, and we're seeing the kind of slippery slope that has happened again with, like, oh, well, we'll give a pass on that. We've seen this with a coach who just said, listen, I'm not doing anything bad. I just want to, at the end of the game, you know, gather people who want to pray.
Right, it's the Supreme Court case, right?
Yeah, yeah, and we've seen that case here, you know, with City Hall, with the state building. Someone who says, well, if you put up a gay flag, why can't I put up this, you know, this Christian flag? You know, the thing is that one of the places where you should feel safe, that you are people of faith and people of no faith that can come together, I would imagine would be a football game.
Yeah, but can I say one last thing about this? I'm making it sound like I'm an advocate for Hobby Lobby here. I'm obviously not, but I'm talking about the value of this thing. If you people watch CNN, Marjorie and I, that's our cable news channel of choice. There are ads almost every night now. Is it Billy Graham Jr.? It's one of the juniors.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
who
yeah,
does
yeah.
a thing there. They're not spending money every night on this for months if they haven't done surveys to suggest that it's connecting with the viewer. I mean, Emmett, you're the most negative about this. I mean, this works in some fashion. Would you agree with that, even if you don't like it?
Well, it does work, Jim, and it works as a marketing and an outreach ploy. The thing is, when you heard it, you immediately used the term social justice, but that's right. actually not what's in the commercial, right? And so we interpret these kind
point.
Of ubiquitous,
a good point.
You know, outreaches and marketing through the lens by which we come to
it's
them.
That's a very good point.
And so that's dangerous, you know, because it does not unhive the beehives, right? It does disengage the unclogged. It actually furthers the segmentation and the separation within Christianity.
Right, and it's proselytizing, it's indoctrination. And it's, again, we still have this, particularly, I think, when we're talking about a changing religious landscape, we're still using, there's still Christianity front and center. No other, let me ask you this. Would we be upset if there was a Muslim ad, a Jewish ad, saying, come to my synagogue, come to my mosque?
No.
You know?
No,
you know, we wouldn't even think about. I mean, we would think this was scandalous, heretical.
I wouldn't.
Yeah, because we're still a very Christian. Listen, we're still a very Christocentric, you know, society. We you might not, Marjorie. Okay, maybe Jim, because Jim don't belong to any religion. But others might find that quite offensive.
Any club that would have me as a member, I wouldn't belong to, in the words of Groucho. You know,
but all religion is proselytizing. That's what goes on at Sunday Mass, at a service in a Protestant church. I mean, proselytizing is what ministers do.
But there's a difference if you do that on your own volition. We, on our own volition, will go into these places of worship. It's very, very different when you decide to turn on your television and be entertained, devoid of religion.
Can I ask you both one before we leave this topic?
Gosh.
I don't want to name names, but we've mentioned repeatedly that they're spending $1 billion on this "He Gets Us" thing. A coworker of mine, I can't remember who it was, asked me this morning, we were discussing this, if $100 million was the same as $1 billion. Could you answer that person's question?
I'm not good in math.
Oh, it was you.
Right?
Okay. Sorry.
That's
I forgot
right.
It was you. I didn't mean
that's
to embarrass
right.
you.
I was confused. When you get beyond 2 + 2 = 4, as I said, I get a little out of my area.
We're talking Irene Monroe and Emmett Price III.
So let's talk about something else, which I thought was an interesting column by Kate Cohen, along the lines of what you're talking about, Irene, going back to a secular country. And she talks about how, for example, if we were a secular nation, if you were someone that believed that you shouldn't see a Prophet Muhammad, if you're a Muslim, if you're a Nation of Islam, then the art, you just don't look at it. You don't wind up getting fired like this professor in Minnesota did when she did show a picture of Muhammad. Or that if you have a addiction problem, you wouldn't get told you had to go to AA because there's a lot of mentions of God or God as you understand him. I think that's how they say it. Give it higher power or whoever you define God in AA, you could go to a secular addiction program. So what do you think of this?
Are you talking to me? Or
yeah, Irene.
Yes,
yeah.
I was talking to you because you were talking about separating, getting all religion out of
I think that what we need those kind of spaces. Remember, we just, I think last month, talked about a Sunni Muslim who was in jail and said, you know, where's that space for me who don't want to listen to Christian broadcasting?
Oh, right, we did.
Right.
You know, so I think that, we got to really understand that, you know, that again, I said it, that we have a different religious landscape. You know, as a matter of fact, the Pew reported that 92% of Americans said they were Christian, but they said that by 2070, only 42% of us will say that we are Christian or even religiously affiliated to some type of church. So I think if we're really truly about a democratizing, you know, people's faith, then we really have to make this separation between church and state. We've just, you know, because anything like the ads we just talked about or any little thing like, oh, okay, that's a good kind of Jesus that we would like to hang out with, is still problematic.
Emmett, what do you think of this Kate Cohen piece? This, by the way, was in the Washington Post, I believe, arguing that we should be a secular nation.
I thought it was a great piece. I'm not sure we need to be a secular nation. I think we can be a pluralist nation. I think we can have multiple religions that are pathways for individuals to select. So I think Irene is correct that we need to be able to select which pathway is for us, and to have equally supported equally, you know, validated pathway. So, you know, AA.
And spaces and safe, you know, spaces.
Alcoholics and Alcoholics Anonymous is built on, you know, principles, and there's a Christian pathway, and then there's a various other pathways that you can take. And I think each person should be able to make that decision for themselves.
But what I like about the 12-step programs, though, because it started in like 1937, so we were clearly a very Christian nation here, that it has adapted to the changing religious landscape here. You know, that's the only thing that at that time when that was that program was developed, it's like, I got to get these. How do you get people to think beyond themselves? And it worked. And it healed a lot of people. But now we're very different. And it's an assault to many more people, particularly as we recognize different groups of people, not just religiously, but in terms of how they identify, whether it is straight, gay, or trans.
So do you think, either of you, that in this University of Minnesota case, this professor should have gotten in trouble for showing the image of Muhammad? She was fired.
Well, you know, no, I don't think she should have got fired. I would say that.
Right. We agree with that. But that was the only thing that we agreed about. But definitely that, you know, she knew the kind of outcome would probably happen doing something that is as incendiary as that. She knew that.
Even though she did all the preparatory work, notified kids in her classroom that this was coming. I mean,
If we're arguing for a secular religion and separation of church and state,
exactly,
then what you show in an art history class, whether it's Muhammad or whether it's Mother and, you know, Jesus and Mary, or whether it's, you know, Byzantine religion, there shouldn't be any restriction on that, right? If we're arguing for a secular...
Go ahead, Irene, first.
Go ahead, Emmett.
I
would say, I can't even imagine Irene just deferred to me.
I know. She's not feeling well, obviously.
This is history. let me take the moment. If, you know, in the instance of a public school, then Marjorie, what you just said is correct. I cannot remember if this school is a private school or not. The private schools have their own kind of editorial perspectives, have their own kind of, you know, philosophies around some of these issues. And I think that the professor was not a tenured professor.
Right.
Most institutions, academic, you know, privilege is for tenured folks. So there's a slippery slope in terms of the power dynamic.
But she was also disrespectful of kids who are Muslim and come from that tradition. The whole idea of being a professor is to hold the space to be sacred and safe for everyone. So my point is that she knew that this would have a kind of incendiary response here. So I don't think she should have been fired, but definitely that lesson plan tanked for that day.
But I guess, again, what I'm saying is, if you're saying we should separate out religion from these things, then why should we not separate out religion from that instance? I mean, Muslims believe certain things, Jews believe certain things, Christians believe certain things. You know, why is it okay to offend Christians or offend Jews and not offend Muslims? I guess it's either one or the other. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think I see it the other way around. I think I see it that for the Muslims in that classroom, they have the right to not be offended, right? So just the same way that the person in jail or prison has the right to not have to do the Christian program, that each individual should have the right in terms of the pathway and what they're exposed to and what they engage in. And so I agree with the sentiment of what you're saying, Margie, but I would flip it.
Yeah. And we have normalized Christian images. We really have. And we have demonized Muslim images. And so therein lies a kind of problem in and of itself. And so I agree where you say, Marjorie, why don't we just do away with all of them, or why don't we just show all of them? That's very, very different, because this is not weighted with the same kind of heft as if, you know, you're looking at a Christian image versus looking at a Muslim image.
One last thing, and I don't really think we have time for it.
I hope we hit the New York.
That's a good introduction.
About,
go ahead.
Yeah, the mandatory reporting, I mean, it seems like obvious to me. New York is debating whether the clergy should be required to report abuse. You're required to do it in Massachusetts unless it's a Catholic confessional or something. But this seems to be in 2023 a no-brainer. Of course they should, shouldn't they?
Quickly, if you can.
Let's go with Emmett first and Irene. Yeah.
Absolutely. No-brainer.
That was
absolutely.
That was a very quick answer. Okay, Irene.
Absolutely. And the point is, it shouldn't be debate because it'd be you're being complicit. Number one, you're saving a child's life. You're stopping a predator, and also you're getting the law involved in it, at least to at least investigate. But this is what I said, because, you know, if you're Protestant, you don't have to worry about your parishioner and clergy confidentiality. So you don't have to worry about ecclesiastical, you know, probation or being, you know, defrocked here. But quite honestly, I would not want to serve any church that didn't allow me to have, you know, be a mandatory, mandate reporter.
You know, even though we don't have much time, I have to say, I understand on paper the reason a lot of the states, like I think, including Massachusetts, that do have priests being mandatory reporters in these cases, have an exemption, as Marjorie said, for what's said in a confessional. If what's said in the confessional leads you to know or believe that a kid is being abused, I don't understand why that should be an exception either. I mean,
that's right.
What is the rationale for that?
I don't know. We kind of understand now. We get a window into the kind of problem that the Catholic Church has. Because could you imagine even priests who may have confessed their sexual predatory nature to another priest or bishop, and again just felt like we have to keep this on the down low.
Exactly.
But I need to say this, though. I mean, I'm being very honest that I couldn't serve a church that allowed this. But I would do what, you know, Pope Francis does, you know, on ridiculous issues. I would just use the middle finger.
It's honesty. He said that was honesty.
It is, isn't it? It is quite honest, wouldn't you say?
I mean, there are times that when words can't capture.
You just give the middle finger. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Before you go, is there a podcast? Or we have the same deal that you've been describing, Irene. What's going on?
We're going to have one next Wednesday. Isn't that right, Emmett?
Next Wednesday?
Next Wednesday. Yep,
next what is
Wednesday.
It?
Yeah, February 15th.
What is it?
On the Embrace. And
great.
On Black.
Oh, good.
Great.
Because there's been such talk.
That continues.
Wonderfully
ridiculous.
Pro.
It's totally ridiculous.
Yeah.
No, it isn't. No, it isn't.
Oh, yes, it is. And by the way, the people who have a problem with it are a small minority of people, I should say. And even the lead critic, the cousin of Coretta Scott King, admitted when he was interviewed by The Guardian that he was trying to get clicks. I mean, really?
Yeah.
Goodbye. Yeah. We'll listen to
but
it. We'll talk
good
about
humor.
It. Goodbye, you two. Good. Well, that it
Leslie
is.
Leslie Jones
we'll
was
you
very
soon.
Funny talking
yeah,
about
sure.
it.
Yes, absolutely.
See you soon, you two.
Okay.
Right, bye.
Thank you very much. The Reverend Irene Monroe is a syndicated religion columnist and the Boston voice of Detours for Defweir's African American Heritage Trail. Emma G. Price III is founding pastor of the Community of Love Christian Fellowship in Austin, the inaugural dean of Africana Studies at Berklee College of Music. Together, they host the All Revved Up podcast, and they're going to have another one. I think the 15th is what they just said. It's a really great podcast. Just days away from a terrible tragedy of a Duxbury mother taking the life of her three young children, we'll discuss maternal mental health and resources available for new mothers facing postpartum depression with the executive director of the Mass PPD Fund. We're going to explain what that is in a second. And Dr. Lena Mittal of Brigham and Women's Hospital. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie Egan and Jim Browdy. Postpartum depression affects 1 in 7 women. It's one of the most common complications of pregnancy, but like broader mental health issues, isn't as talked about. In the wake of the tragic deaths of those three young kids in Duxbury and the charges filed against the mother. We're joined now by Jesse Colbert, who's founder and executive director of the Mass PPD Fund, to discuss some of the resources available for parents dealing with this issue. We're also joined by Dr. Alina Mittal. She's medical director of the Equity Substance Use and Community Partnerships, MCPAP, for moms, also an instructor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and chief of the Division of Women's Health at Brigham. Welcome to you both, and thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming in. So Jim touched on it, saying postpartum depression affects one in seven women. But I'm always struck by the fact that post-childbirth, everybody's worried about the baby and not so worried about the mom. So, Jesse, talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. There has been a quote recently that the mom is treated, so like the baby's a candy and the mom's a wrapper, and then the mom is discarded. There's so much contact with the healthcare system in this, we call perinatal period during childbirth, during the pregnancy and after childbirth, and yet not much attention to the mom, not much attention to the mom's mental health. It's almost like, you know, see you later after the baby comes. So I think, that is absolutely true. I think that's true in our culture. That's true in our policies. At the same time, there are some terrific things going on, including the program that Dr. Mittal is here to talk about, McPAP for Moms, that's trying to address some of these gaps.
Why don't you jump right to that? We're going to do that later, Doctor, but since it was just mentioned, tell us about the program.
So McPAP for Moms is a statewide consultation service. It's free to all providers who are working with individuals who are perinatal, meaning before pregnancy, during pregnancy, yeah, and immediately after pregnancy, who may have substance use or mental health concerns. And we're really a capacity building resource for providers who may not feel comfortable addressing those mental health and substance use needs without a sort of brief expert consultation. So we do phone consultations, in-person consultations, and also referral to resources like perinatal-focused psychotherapy, support groups, and so on.
But when you make those referrals, we've had this discussion ad nauseum vis-a-vis mental health treatment. Referral to who? I mean, yeah, part of the problem is, you know, there's that 900 number now for a whole variety of things, or the wonderful work you're doing. Is there the infrastructure, the human infrastructure, to provide help to people who ask for it?
Well, I guess what I'd say is that, well, firstly, no, there is not enough mental health resource out there. Even outside of the perinatal period, we have a mental health boarding crisis throughout the Commonwealth. We have an immense gap between need and resources in mental health care. However, one thing that we at McPAP for Moms believe strongly is that there are providers who aren't necessarily designated mental health care providers, like an obstetrician or a midwife, a primary care provider, a psychiatrist who's not a perinatal psychiatrist, but has a relationship with an individual, an emergency room physician. All these are potential doors to treatment, and they can initiate medication. They can have brief conversations that can be the beginning of a springboard into treatment.
You know, I want to talk about medication in a minute, Doctor, if we can. But going back to you, Jesse, for a second, in addition to whatever resources are available to the mother, what sort of resources are available for the partner, family, friends to be able to try to recognize symptoms of a developing problem, whether it's depression or in these rare cases, postpartum psychosis, as allegedly applies to Lindsay Clancy, even though no experts have said that yet. What's there for people around that person who want to be helpful?
Yeah. There are a couple of excellent resources that I would recommend. And one is Postpartum Support International, and they have a terrific chapter here in Massachusetts. Another big national organization that has really good information is the Maternal Mental Health Leadership Alliance. I think in terms of supports that are out there, it is really piecemeal. You may be able to find a support group. You may be able to find mental health care. You may know it exists. You may not. And McPAP for Moms has just done an incredible job training OBGYNs who can be a really important pathway to care. But I think the big problem is that it is really catch as catch can. And in the coverage around this, I think it's misleading to say that somebody fell through the cracks. because that implies a system. There are terrific resources, but whether we're really doing what we need to do to get people to care, which means screening, which means that handholding, that wraparound care to make that connection from a positive screen to care. And is there care on the other end of that that is accessible, that is culturally congruent, that really works? You know, I don't know. It's really very, very inconsistent. So one of the things we do is try to get the word out about the resources that do exist. And it's really interesting because the more you talk about those things, you know, the more MCPAP does, the more it kind of unearths the need that nobody is talking about because people start to come forward with this.
We're talking with Jesse Colbert, founder and executive director of the Mass Postpartum Depression Fund, and Dr. Lena Mittal, medical director of Equity, Substance Use, and Community Partnerships, MCPAP for Moms, from Brigham and Women's. You know, I'm beating a dead horse, I guess, because I talked about this the other day. But one of the things, doctor, and I don't mean to pick on doctors or certainly hospitals, but it does seem that we don't, as I was saying to Jesse, have a lot of care for mom. It's a lot, you know, there's not the practical things when you're pregnant about, do you have a washer dryer? Who's going to help you with the baby? What about how much time does your partner have to be with you? All these things, which you seem to get a lot more of if you go to midwives or if you have a birthing center. But we have almost none of those anymore. I think there's only one left in Massachusetts. I think the Brigham used to have a midwife service. I don't know if they still do. But there's something, I think, wrong about the whole process in many ways.
Well, so the Brigham does have a midwifery service. A lot of hospital systems have midwifery services that work kind of alongside obstetricians or in those same structures, not in birth centers enough anymore. You're right that birth centers are really a different structure that sort of exists separate from the practice of midwifery.
Yeah.
I do think that what you're alluding to, though, is that there is a sort of an absence of wraparound need. And one of the appeals of midwifery care, which is also can be integrated into obstetric care kind of more broadly, is this kind of holistic view of the individual who's pregnant, the perinatal individual, the family, the partner, kind of like thinking about concentric circles around that individual. And I think that's really lacking. And I also think thinking about physical health and then drawing a further concentric circle around behavioral health and emotional health and psychosocial health and wellness and community wellness is really lacking as well. But it's something that is not distinct to just any particular field, but really healthcare in general.
Dr. Yeah. Mittal, can we stay with you for a second? You mentioned drugs in passing a minute ago. Can you tell us what is available, how accessible it is, how affordable it is or is not?
So, you know, I think psychiatric treatment, or meaning I think what you're asking about is sort of psychopharmacologic treatment, medications to treat mental health conditions, really can be prescribed by any prescribing provider and are covered in similar ways as other medications. The issue is really being able to see a provider if things are not going through the usual process. So if somebody starts, you know, is detected to have some kind of high risk need for depression, meaning depression care. So they have a positive screen in their OB office or their primary care office, and that individual puts forward, some prescription for an antidepressant, that most often results in positive benefits. But in the situation where that medication isn't adequate or needing to think about adjustment or switching to a different medication or the needs become more complex, really referring to subspecialty care beyond that primary care is really where things get more challenging. Access to medications in terms of cost really isn't so different than medications for somatic or medical illness in the body. It's really about the expertise around prescribing and accessing a psychiatric prescriber that becomes more challenging.
Mm-hmm. Jesse, is this something that is newer for pregnancy and birth? I mean, that maybe, because I don't think when I was young, we talked much about postpartum depression, or certainly there weren't the kind of pharmaceuticals available then that are available now. So I'm wondering, you know, the horrible case down in Duxbury with this poor family with the loss of the three little kids, the mother's lawyer, Kevin Reddington, claimed she was taking 13 different drugs, which seems to me to be a lot, but I'm not a pharmaceutical person. So is this sort of a newer area?
Yeah, I mean, I'll answer your first question about whether the prevalence has increased. I don't think so. I think people are talking about it more. One of the things that we do to raise awareness and reduce stigma is to tell stories in different contexts. And one thing that a lot of survivors say is once they finally came forward with this to their mother said, oh, yeah, I had a terrible depression after you were born. And the survivor is like, well, thanks for giving me the heads up. You know, so I think that's more about, are we talking about it? I think in terms of medication, the data is there, and I would defer to Dr. Mittal that these medications are safe and effective. And I think the public conversation around it kind of loses that. I think it's really tricky and really upsetting. And the message that I think is really much more important is just how medication can be an important part of care, and also how much more care is needed across the continuum here in Massachusetts and around the country, from the most common, you know, complication of pregnancy, 1 in 5, postpartum depression and anxiety, down to acute care and some medications, acute care, inpatient care, not available in Massachusetts. Folks have to go to Rhode Island. So I think nothing about
folks
this
have
is
to
needed.
Go to Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. Why? Yeah. Why?
Well, there is a mother baby unit there if you are acutely ill. And again, I think as a doc treating patients on this issue, I would defer to Dr. Mittal to comment more on that.
Do you want to do that, doctor?
I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, thanks, Jesse. I think that there are a couple things to talk about here. And one is that the sort of spectrum of care for mental health is really broad. And so most routine treatment happens on an outpatient basis where somebody goes to see a therapist, may have talk therapy, they have a prescriber, whether that's a psychiatrist or a psychiatric prescriber or even their primary care provider. But then at the other end of the spectrum, there's inpatient psychiatric care. So if somebody's not safe or is having very severe symptoms, they may go to a psychiatric unit. We have many psychiatric units in Massachusetts, but what Jesse is describing is that there are not inpatient psychiatric units that are specifically tailored for individuals who are perinatal to be admitted to alongside their baby. And that is a model that is much more common in other parts of the world. And there are a few units around the United States, but there are none in Massachusetts. The program referenced in Rhode Island is actually a day hospital, which is sort of in between the ambulatory and the inpatient care. It is not an inpatient unit. And we really value the incredible service that is provided by these intermediate sort of levels of care where people can go with high level need and significant illness. They go perhaps with their baby or not, depending on their specific situation. And then they return home or don't sleep within that program, but they're getting intensive services. So there's kind of like a full spectrum.
You know, Dr. Mittal, staying with you for a minute, we've through the years on this show, we've talked about health equity, but the acceleration of that discussion has happened during the pandemic, particularly thanks to people like Michael Curry, who most recently is head of this Health Equity Compact, which is an organization of 55 people of color in your business who put together this coalition, filed legislation on Beacon Hill. In almost every situation where we've had discussions around health equity, people of color, and in this case, I'm asking women of color, are worse sufferers, have worse outcomes. Does that same unfortunate rule of thumb apply to these issues?
Yes, unfortunately, the more marginalization that a person experiences, that sort of carries forward across all domains. And so Black women are at higher risk for mortality and high risk morbidity during the course of the birthing process. Individuals who identify as Black or Hispanic have higher prevalence of positive screens, as we call them, when screened for depression in the perinatal period. Of those who are screened positive or up to have high risk for a behavioral health condition, the rates of landing in and engaging with care are lower. So referral rates are lower, and then completion of treatment or entering into treatment are lower. So there are inequities across the spectrum.
Jesse, let's talk a little bit about postpartum psychosis, which is very rare, but what is the difference between that and just depression, and how rare is it?
Is that for myself or for...
I'm sorry. I was asking Jesse, but if you feel... Is that a question that you can deal with? What the difference is between depression then going into psychosis and how rare that psychosis is, I think.
Jesse? So postpartum psychosis is generally associated with a more severe mood disorder called bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. Most often it is... it's related to somebody who either may have a prior history of bipolar disorder, or in the perinatal period, it sort of gets unmasked because of the abrupt hormonal shifts. Postpartum depression is incredibly more prevalent. Postpartum psychosis occurs in about 1 in 1,000 perinatal individuals. And of that group, this is considered a psychiatric emergency, requiring urgent connection to psychiatric care, whether that's through an emergency room or an urgent appointment with a psychiatric prescriber and, the treatment team. But only in very, very, very rare cases will something that severe result in harm to others. And so I think it's important to think about postpartum psychosis as an extreme illness, which even more rarely results in harm to self and others. Postpartum depression, on the other hand, quite common. 1 in 5 individuals may experience depression or anxiety, which sort of exists on a spectrum. And much, much, much more rarely than even in the context of bipolar disorder, postpartum depression can worsen to include psychotic symptoms. But this is not this is by far the exception and not the rule.
You know, since we're talking a little bit about this case in passing, Jesse, this is for you. Does it matter to what the two of you and others do how Lindsay Clancy is treated in this case? I don't know if I'm articulating that terribly well, but the more someone like me who knew virtually nothing about postpartum psychosis reads about it, assuming that ultimately is determined what she suffered from, one has, at least I have real questions, I hope others do, as to whether or not the criminal justice system is the right place to be addressing those kinds of things. Does the outcome of this case matter in terms of how people see the whole spectrum of issues that people like you two deal with, whether it's psychosis, depression, whatever it is?
This is a big question. This tragedy has kind of taken over in the last couple of weeks for folks that work on this issue. Our hearts go out to this family.
Of course.
It's just the most horrible thing you can imagine. This was, somebody desperate who was trying really, really hard to get help. Beyond that, I don't know any particulars about it. And to answer your question, does it matter how she is treated? Absolutely. There are some, policy efforts going on around this that we hope to revisit. There's a state postpartum depression commission in the state. There was a bill last year to look at sentencing when a postpartum illness is present. And that is something that has only been passed in Illinois, and it's retroactive. So other sentences could be revisited under a law like that. We're looking at maybe revisiting that and tying it to some other systemic changes. So when you ask that question, I think about the larger issue, but I also think there is one, I think about the person, again, who I don't know, but it's a real person, and this is just the most heartbreaking story you can imagine.
Jesse Colbert, one last thing before you go. If people are now, their siblings, their partners, their children, their daughters are about to give birth, what kind of things should they be looking for with their new moms or even not so new moms? Just those months after the baby comes.
I'd love to share this question with Dr. Mittal. I think we need to think in an entirely different way about how we are supporting mothers and parents. I think the pandemic brought this to light. in this culture, there's just not much support or recognition or structures or a culture around supporting. So never mind an illness. We need to support new parents, and there are all kinds of things that we need to be doing so much better to do that. You know, I think Dr. Mattel could speak to some of the symptoms to look out for.
Go ahead, Doctor. We're short on time, but what should people look out for?
Yeah, I think the most important thing to be looking for is challenges in functioning. And so really, if somebody is having an emotional reaction in the immediate aftermath of giving birth, there is a real commonality to that. It's really when those kinds of symptoms impact functioning. If somebody's not feeling like getting out of bed, not doing their usual activities, not connecting with their usual supports, or having a significant low self-appraisal, or much more concerning thoughts of harm to self or others, that's when we think about mental health conditions and really needing treatment. And that's when there are a lot of open doors. Obstetrician, midwives, primary care, pediatric providers are all important points of entry into beginning the conversation about how to access mental health treatment for caregivers of all sorts, whether it's the gestational individual or the non-gestational caregiver or family.
One last very quick thing, Jesse, very quickly. If people had to write down one number, one web address, if they have questions or issues, what would that be? What's the best entry point?
There are two: Postpartum Support International, postpartum.net, mm-hmm. and then the National Mental Health Hotline, which is 1-833-9-HELP-4, the number 4, MOMS.
4 MOMS. 833-9-HELP-4-MOMS. Thank you hugely, both of you. Really appreciate your joining us today.
Yeah, thank you very much. We've been speaking with Jesse Colbert, founder and executive director of the Mass PPD Fund, and Dr. Lena Mattel, medical director of the Equity, Substance Use, and Community Partnerships, MCPAP for Moms. She's also an instructor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and chief of the Division of Women's Health at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Thank you both very much for being with us today. Up next, we're going to open the lines and ask you about something that is not nearly as serious, but it's been a constant for a lot of us out there. How do you get yourself out of social situations you don't want to be in? A new study says people spend 51 minutes before deciding to bail on a bad date. Are you that generous? The number is 877-301-8970. You can call or text us at that number. How do you get out of there when you don't want to be there anymore? You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Mardrigue and Jim Browdy. We are at the library tomorrow. We hope you join us. A new highly scientific study has just found that people give a first date roughly 51 minutes before making up some excuse to bail. So whether you're not feeling well, your date looks too much like your sibling, or you've just realized you don't actually want to be in a relationship with anyone, all reasons people give in a survey conducted by something called OnePoll. I think the time frame is more like 5 minutes deciding if you like the person and 46 minutes coming up with a good excuse to get away. So we want to hear from you. What's your threshold for leaving social situations, not just dates? It could be a conversation with somebody you just don't want to be in anymore. Are you like me, who unabashedly walks out of any room with no excuse at all? Or are you like Marjorie, quietly nodding and continuing to actively listen, maybe for hours, until you finally make your escape because you just remembered a pipe burst in your basement? The number is 877-301-8970 is the number. You know, if you want to do it in a date context, it's fine. I think it's in any social interaction. How do you get out of that thing if you've decided it has run its course? And by the way, do not even think of asking Marjorie for advice on this thing.
No, don't.
Because what
don't.
I just described is exactly right.
Well, I'm in a majority, though. If you read the story down far enough, it says lots of people will sit there forever because they don't, they're too embarrassed to say anything. They don't want to be rude or impolite. But I love some of these excuses people have.
Like what?
Because apparently lots of people do leave mid-date, and the strategies they have for leaving include having friends phone with a fake emergency. That's always a good one. Alerting your friend that they should call you in a half an hour, and it's a fake emergency if you want to get out of there, and then it's just a friendly call if you don't. Claiming to have a headache, Jim, or saying their pet is very ill. Unclear how they figured that out in the middle of the date. And they also talk about emergency at work. That's a big one, too. So anyway, 877-301.
Why are you unable to? I'm sorry. What, you give the number, and then I have a question for you.
877-301-8970. It is the number you can call or text us to say whether you would actually wait 51 minutes before making excuses to end a bad date or a bad interaction. Or in Jim's case, how do you just do what you do, Jim, which you've done to me on so many occasions. Yeah. Just get up and leave.
Well, first of all, I exaggerate.
Leave me sitting there with the situation.
Let me tell you what the key is.
To handle myself.
This is something about which Marjorie knows nothing because she is far too kind, far too patient. And literally, if you start talking to Marjorie and want to talk until Thursday, she'll talk with you till Thursday. Here are the keys. I'm going to give you some advice before you give us a buzz or a text at 877-301-8970. If you're involved in a conversation with something, movement is key. Keep moving in the conversation.
Keep moving.
Don't
stand
still. If you stand still, you're establishing like a venue, a location for this continued thing. Keep moving, even if slowly. Secondly, I can't believe you don't even know this. You know what the key to ending it is? You shake hands with the person. Doesn't matter where they are in the conversation or anything else. You shake hands with the person. You know what shaking hands means? I'm leaving.
Yeah,
and
I'm leaving.
Even if you're not leaving, I am leaving. You politely say, I really enjoyed this conversation. It was great talking to you. As you're moving, by the way, you shake hands with the person, and then you are out of there. That is the solution to the Marjorie Egan conundrum. 877-301-8970.
You know, they have these great excuses that people give in this survey for getting out of the date if they don't want to go on the date.
Yeah.
And they tell the person, this is before they get to the restaurant or the coffee shop, wherever they're going, that they can't come on the date because they've been arrested. That's a good one. Or because your date looks too similar to your ex. A pipe burst at home. That actually did happen to a lot of us during this cold spell.
That would be you. You just say you've been mugged. That's another excuse, too. Saying you've been mugged.
They use you've been mugged.
Is an old standby. That's
now,
a good one.
I think a good one, if you decide you don't want to go meet someone, I'm surprised it wasn't on the list because I heard this used very frequently, especially by kids, parents, you know, who were out in the dating world after a divorce or separation or whatever, and their kids played sports, was to say that you had caught head lice from one of your children.
Absolutely right.
That's always a
conversation
ender right there.
The beauty of the advice that you're giving is it's advice about what we're not talking about. We're not talking about not going on a date. We're talking about extricating yourself from any social situation. You get there. You're talking to somebody. Let's say at the Boston Public Library or on a date. Do you have any strategy for ending
well,
a conversation
in college,
ever?
Or if, in college or when I was young, what you do is I had to go to the bathroom and then I'd never come out.
You just stay in the bathroom until they left?
Try to get out.
Can
the
I tell you the one thing that I really
like that
offends me? The one thing you should not do, and I don't think I'm alone, is when someone says to me, this gives me hives, they can't even say it, I'll let you go. Really? I didn't ask for you to let me go. If I wanted to be let go, I'd let go myself. I don't need you to let – you know what I mean? Does that trouble you? Obviously, it doesn't bother you either.
No, it seems that they're taking control of the situation when really you aren't being in control
of
the situation.
877-301-8970. We're going to restructure this. We're going to give Marjorie advice about how she can extricate herself from social situations, from conversations.
Going to the
in
bathroom
a relatively
is a big one.
Finite time.
The problem is if someone waits for you outside
the
bathroom,
then
you have to figure out another strategy.
Yeah.
And they also say in this strategy,
in this story,
that as you mentioned before, it takes 25 minutes to notice a spark or lack thereof. Mm-hmm. Don't you find that an awful long time to notice a spark or lack thereof?
Or lack thereof. I do, Marjorie, I do. Yes, I do.
Yeah.
And you go ahead.
Back in your wild and woolly college days, I would assume you assess the spark in the first couple of seconds.
I was moving quickly then too, Marjorie. Even back then, I perfected the quick movement in conversation thing, and it gets you moving there. 877-301-8970. 8970 is our phone. By the way, someone said this is true. Paul Simon said it best. There are 50 ways to leave your lover. That is exactly
Listen
true. What's that?
To Bill from Shrewsbury.
What did he say?
I have a friend who went on a blind date. They met up at a pub, sat in a booth, ordered drinks. He excused himself to use the men's room, walked out the back door, and never came back.
Well, there's that guy. That doesn't count. There's that guy in California who took women to unbelievably expensive places and then left the place with saying he was going to the men's room or something, and then left the $400 dinner check on the table. Remember that guy? There's
I've
a
heard
name
that
for
one.
Him. Yeah.
He was a grifter is what he was.
Well, he was worse than a grifter, I think.
Yeah, but I've heard this one a lot, where people go out on a date for dinner, blind date, which is a big mistake. It seems to me, meet someone for coffee or something like that so you can get out of there quickly. But in any case, they were out for dinner, and then the dinner bill comes, and the man takes out an American Express card. Now I'm being sexist. This is a man-woman
date. Perfectly
right,
yeah.
Anyway, the man takes out an American Express card, and the wait person comes over and says, "We don't take American Express cards here." And then the person says, I didn't realize you didn't take American Express cards. That's the only credit card I have.
I love that.
And then the other half of the date ends up picking up the entire meal.
Well, it sounds like Marjorie does know what she's doing. Here are two suggestions from listeners that are excellent. Ted from Marshfield says, just do the Santos method. My mother just died again. That's one possibility. I think that's very successful. Here's another one. This is brilliant. I took a screenshot of someone calling my cell phone and put it as my background. So if I need to get out, I can look at my phone at any time, and everyone believes I'm stepping out to take a phone call. Patrick, that is brilliant. Maureen in a car, your first.
Hi, Maureen.
Sorry it took us so long to get there. Hi, Maureen.
Hi, first time caller, long time listener.
Thank you a lot.
Guys.
Thank you.
This was a number of years ago before cell phones.
Yeah.
But I had joined a video dating service, and so I knew what the person looked like. I knew a little bit about them. So we met for dinner at a really nice restaurant in Andover.
Yeah.
And within 5 minutes, I knew he was just not the one.
Yeah.
And he started asking me questions as if I were at a job interview. and he said, "Do you speak French? Do you like French food? Do you play tennis?" So I said, okay. He's doing a checklist. And then all of a sudden, from across the room, his parents walked in.
Oh, my God.
And he was French, and she was a pro tennis player. And I thought, okay, that does it. I know where this guy's going.
And that was it?
So anyway, no. So I said, I've got to call my sister because
I like
the baby was screaming when I left.
Love that.
So I called the sister, and I came back and I said, "I'm so sorry. My sister really needs help with the baby, so I'm going to have to go." So then he walks me out to my car. He was a Mutual of Omaha salesman.
Of course he was.
And he said, "Well, maybe you'll be interested in some insurance." And he gave me a coloring book from my niece.
Excellent.
And some insurance information.
How long have you been married, you two, by the way, Maureen? Maureen, we got to go. That was an excellent story.
That was a great
Thank
call.
You.
I
very
love the
much.
Parents showing up at the date. That's an unusual strategy.
By the way, here's Kyle in Medford. I hope I can say this on the air. Tell me if this is inappropriate. I'm with Jim. I will just leave, maybe say goodbye, or else just an Irish goodbye. Is that okay to say an Irish goodbye?
Yes, that means you sneak out without saying goodbye.
That's where you just leave.
That's
someone said that to
me
recently. Yeah.
Okay, Allie from Duxbury is once on a date at Olive Garden Hyannis. I texted my sister to help bail me out. She called and said my dog had just gotten run over by an ice cream truck.
Oh, that's good.
It was the middle of December. I had to try not to laugh while making it look like an actual emergency.
I like that
a lot. Let's go to Bob in York Harbor. Hi, Bob.
Thank you, Bob.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have the perfect line.
What is it?
Well, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
Hello?
We got you. Just speak.
Okay. So I have the perfect line. I jump up. I say, "Oh, my God, I just remembered. I got a roast in the oven," and I run.
I love it.
Every time.
I love that. Have you ever had a roast in the oven?
Never.
Never. Exactly. It makes it even better. You have nailed it, Bob. Beautiful strategy. Thank you for the call.
Ted from Marshfield says you can just do the Santos method. My mother just died again.
I just read that.
You did?
I read it. So his mother died twice, actually, right in a row. It's unbelievable.
I'm sorry. I was looking at the other emails and I wasn't listening.
Alan in Framingham, you have 30 seconds. Take it away.
Okay. Yeah, in my life, I always noticed that telling the truth is actually better than lying. So I would just tell the truth and say I'm no longer interested in this date.
Wow.
I don't see any chemistry. You can blame it on me if you want to.
Beautiful.
But I'm going to go.
That is beautiful, Alan. Thank you for ending this discussion. That was beautiful. No, that's beautiful. Truth is something. It's really
It's not really good. A lot of people, I want to say, have used to go to the ladies' room and go to the men's room.
You know what you should do? Like Marjorie, the truth, Alan from Framingham, the truth would be, let me just, I'm Marjorie now. I would tell you, if you keep talking to me, I'm going to be here for 3 hours. I really have to pee. So is there any chance we could terminate this? So
yeah.
In any case.
The problem is if you're stuck in there, you have to find a ladies' room or a men's room with a
peephole
window so you can climb out the back window.
That's good.
And escape. Okay, we are done. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio.
God,
and keep up with us 24/7 by way of our podcast.
Great song.
It is a great song. 50 ways to leave your lover. Okay, we're live at the Boston Public Library tomorrow with NBC Sports Boston's Trenny Casey, ACLU of Massachusetts, Carol Rose, the Boston Foundation's Lee Pelton, and our food policy analyst, Corby Comer, plus CNN's John King. We want to thank our crew, Zoe Matthews, Aidan Conley, Brendan Deedy. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. Brian Bell was on the boards for us today. Our executive producer is Jamie Bologna. Got the back, Jack, Jim.
I know, it's pretty good.
Take a new plan, Sam.
You know, I was driving down Boylston Street a couple of nights ago, and I saw the head at the theater. I can't remember which theater. It said Simon and Garfunkel, and I thought they were having a reunion. Do you remember we went to the reunion?
I do.
When we were at the other radio station?
Yeah.
We were the only people that didn't have walkers with us. Do you remember that? It's a rather old crowd.
Okay.
In any case, there's nothing wrong with that. It's true. I was telling the truth, just like Alan from Framingham said. We got to go. We'll be at the library tomorrow. We really hope you join us. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan. Thanks again for tuning in today. I hope you can tune in tomorrow. If you're in the neighborhood, stop by at the Boston Public Library. You don't need a reservation. You can pop in or pop out. Stay as little as long as you like. Plus, the Newsfeed Cafe is there for a nice cup of coffee or a nice sandwich. Jim, thank you very much for showing up
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Meanwhile, hope everybody has a great day and hope you can tune in again tomorrow.